Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your new host, the great Brian Last. Here on this show, we don't just break kayfabe on wrestling. We break kayfabe on music, TV, motion pictures, grass, stereos, upholstery, whatever you want. We break kayfabe on life! I want to now introduce my co-host from Paris Island, South Carolina, Barry Rose.
The DA, this is awesome, man. So yes, yeah, so it's, you know, I know Jeff resigned this past week.
Good riddance.
Looking for that million dollar contract and apparently didn't get it. So, so I'm here. I'll be your sidekick from this point forward, Brian. Anything that you need, if I can get you coffee, you or Mr. Fuller, you please let me know.
No. What the fuck? How could you stab me in the back like that, Barry Rose?
Really? That was funny.
I'm going to start my own basketball podcast, by God.
I must admit, I did not expect Barry to turn so quickly.
Wow.
Barry didn't even hesitate. Barry was like, all right, like, a new day.
It was like Ernie Ladd on Miami Beach that one night.
That's right, which we're going to talk about that on today's episode, Jeff, because when we're talking about the Robinson-Sheruta match, we're actually going to do it.
Before I jump off, I just want to say here at the top of the show, this is 1 year of Breaking Kayfabe here on the Arcadia.
Wait, this is legitimate? This is actually recording right now?
Yes! We are recording right now.
Okay, wait a minute here.
That changed everything, you see?
I thought we were just fucking around here.
I put a swerve on you.
Oh, all right. I like it, actually. All right.
Listen, guys, real quick, before I jump off and let you guys do what people actually want to hear, I just want to real quick say here at the top, it's a year now that Breaking Kayfabe has been on Arcadian Vanguard, and it's been a little over a year since me and Jeff started talking about it at first, and of course, you were right there from the beginning, and eventually you were the permanent co-host, and this has quickly become such a popular show. I hear about it from so many people each week, and it is a show I'm proud to be a part of. I know I'm not on the air each week, but I'm a part of each episode, and I'm proud to be. And here's to 1 year, and here's to many, many more, because this is such a great show. And here's to the brothership right here on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Congratulations on 1 year, guys, and do a good show now that I'll leave.
And on this show, we are not just going to break kayfabe or break kayfabe. We're going to break kayfabe on wrestling, sports, movies, television, pop culture. We, in fact, for one fucking year, I've been breaking kayfabe on life, ladies and gentlemen, and we will continue to do so. From Paris Island, South Carolina, Sergeant Barry Rose. How you doing, Barry?
I'm doing good. I think my head is spinning. I was caught completely off guard. I had no idea that was coming. But that was a lot of fun. I like when you throw these surprises. And let me just say it has been a fun year. When you approached me a year ago, my words to you were, Jeff, I would like to do it, but I can't do it. I had a lot going on, work, life, you know, breaking kayfabe on life, but I have a son going to college, and I said, I just can't do it. And you approached me after two or three episodes and said, would you reconsider? And it took me about 4 seconds to say, yeah, I would love to do it. And part of it is, I love doing it every week. You know, just being a part where you and I can just take our conversations that usually, I've said it millions of times, not millions, but maybe 20 or 30 times, this is just an extension of the phone conversations that you and I would have. So being able to do that and to share that with everybody is just a lot of fun. And you know, thanks to Brian, obviously, for what he's doing. Thanks to you for having the vision. This is not something I could ever attempt on my own. You're kind of the ringleader, in a sense, in a positive way, not in a negative way, but you're kind of the glue that keeps all this together. So it's hard to believe it's been a year.
Well, they said it couldn't be done. No, they thought they kicked me out of their little fucking group and that I would just hide away. But no, I'm still here after 1 year. So enjoy your fucking dinner. But anyway, Barry, a couple quick things before we start today. Going to tell everybody what we're going to talk about. Today, we are going to take Barry Rose back some 40 years. We're going to Miami Beach and we're going to talk about a match between two of Barry's favorite wrestlers of all time, Jumbo Tsuruta and Billy Robinson. We are also on this special one-year anniversary edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. Barry, finally, we are going to talk about my choice for the number one match of the entire decade of the 1980s. We are going to Nashville, Tennessee, May 8th, 1989, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, and Ricky Steamboat. We're finally going to sit down and talk about that match and whether or not it still holds up as a great match. We're also going to give a top five Going back there, we're going to talk about our favorite top five movies pre-1970. Yes, you're going to have to think outside the box, all you youngsters. We're going to make you go back in time and check out some great movies that were maybe before mom and dad's time even, because there have been great films for 60, 70 years now, Barry, and we want to expand some horizons, and we want some people to just take a look at some different stuff. Also, Barry, I surprised you with a very special interview that will take place here on today's episode. Barry, who are we going to interview? Why don't you just tell the folks?
Absolutely. We are interviewing the son of one of my favorite wrestlers of all time that you just mentioned, Jumbo Tsuruta. We will have Yuji Tsuruta on air with us today.
And we're looking forward to it. We had a great time talking to Yuji, who's not only a big wrestling fan, but a big movie fan and a big music fan. That sounds like our kind of guy, don't you think, Barry?
You know what? It's breaking kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry and Yuji from this point forward.
We're going to be breaking kayfabe from Japan, folks.
Wow.
Now, we Skyped across the Atlantic on the Twilight Zone episode. Now we're Skyping across the Pacific. And I'm thinking Ashley at this point is going, you friggin' call the Pacific and you didn't call me? Well, anyway, I digress. Barry, before we start on the topics for today's show, I know that last night, as of this recording, you and your son, Zach, had a chance to go to a concert that was sort of a fulfillment of all your musical loves. Why don't you real quick just tell the folks about what you did last night with Zach?
Absolutely. And at the end of this story, I am going to break kayfabe, but I'm going to reveal something, Jeff, that I've never told anybody outside of my immediate family. And Jeff, you don't even know about this, so I'm going to surprise you. Yeah, this is going to be, but let me tell you. So last night, I had the opportunity to go to a revival concert, in the sense of 80s bands, and it's called Lost 80s, Lost 80s Live. And it was essentially, it's eight bands from the 1980s that all had huge hits in the 80s, but for whatever reason, didn't have quite the success, whether 90s and going forward. So, as I bought my tickets, and I think I bought my tickets at some point in May, as I discovered, I was the first person to buy tickets and looking at my ticket numbers. So that just shows my dedication. But it's no secret, you know, when it comes to music, I'm very much attracted to the 80s, one-hit wonders, new wave music, you know, it very, very little of the classic rock, which I really enjoy, though, but that doesn't really fall into, you know, the concerts that I go and see. But anyways, I was able to score tickets to this, obviously being the first person to buy them, and it was headlined by Flock of Seagulls, Wang Chung, Animotion, Gene Loves Jezebel, Dramarama, Naked Eyes, Annabella Lewin from Bow Wow Wow, still a lovely woman, by the way, if you remember her from 35 years ago. And who else was there? When in Rome, the guys who sang The Promise, which actually came along around 89, so it was kind of the tail end, but it was an incredible show, and I'm going to correlate it to something that wrestling fans will understand, but it was a great show. It was eight bands. Each band sang somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 6 songs. Most were about 4 songs, some 5 songs. So they were only up on stage for maybe 20, 25 minutes max. I would say even closer to like 20 minutes. And the time in between sets was only 5 or 10 minutes. So this was an event that was constantly flowing. The crowd was super energized. And that really, to me, as it does with professional wrestling, it really, to me, makes it so exciting. The crowd popped literally for everything. You know, Annabella Lewin came out, and she was the second act that came out. And when she started doing Do You Want to Touch Me, which was her other big song other than I Want Candy with Bow Wow Wow, the place just went nuts. But, you know, I got to say, and my son and I were joking about this too, if you've ever wanted to see 50-something-year-old people completely lose their shit, just play Everybody Wang Chung tonight, because it was, when they started playing that song, you had people that were in their 40s, 50s, 60s, some even older, I'm sure, just jumping up and down and losing their mind. And this is where I'm going to actually correlate this to wrestling, is I went to an indie show last September. So it's just a little over a year. And it was a show that was put on by Jody Malenko, Jody Simon, as he was trying to, it was a fundraiser, trying to raise funds for the Wall of Fame, which is in the old Fort Hesterly Armory, which is now the JCC. So he put on a live wrestling card, and it was held in the JCC, and it was their first wrestling card. And again, it's the same structure of the building where they had, you know, thousands of wrestling events and thousands of wrestling matches and world title changes in Tampa. So it's a historic building. And it really got me thinking, because that night was one of the best cards I had been to. And it wasn't in-ring action, because a lot of the guys were guys who were either retired or semi-retired. There were some guys in their 50s. You know, it wasn't like a Kenny Omega. They didn't have all the hot indie names there. It was, you know, guys who basically had either been trained by Malenko or were Malenko guys, and guys who don't wrestle frequently. It was, you know, guys who were retired. But the crowd was so excited for what was taking place that day. There was such a buzz and such an energy that I walked out and I said, wow. I said, you know, if we're going on a Meltzer star rating, the best match of the night might have been a star, maybe a star and a half. So not, you know, not this amazing in-ring work, but the crowd made the event. Last night was really similar. You know, Animotion, who sings Obsession, you know, they're both right around 60. And the woman, I don't know if you remember her, she was pretty attractive years ago. Well, she's 60 years old now, and she kind of looks like she could be somebody's grandmother. And I don't mean that as a knock in any form, just an older woman. But they were having so much fun up on stage. And by turn, the audience in the crowd was having so much fun that my son and I was just blown away. And when In Rome came on, and they sang that song, Jeff, The Promise, which was a huge hit in 89. And it's a good song, but, you know, they never had a follow-up. They're legitimately one-hit wonders. And they came out and they did, I guess, a 15-minute version of the song, but it wasn't just the song. It was kind of acoustic, and then it got really like techno, and then they did the straight version, and then they did a sing-along, and this was incorporated into just one act. And when it was over, my son said, that's probably the highlight of the night. And going into it, it was like, you know, when in Rome, we're going to hear The Promise and we're going to move on. So it was really exciting. But for me, I'm so into the 80s. And, you know, whenever we did the two one-hit wonder shows. And, you know, my God, did I just eat that up. And I think you and I talked afterwards, and I know I mentioned it publicly, but those were probably my favorite shows. And then we went into the songs that we hate, which I also said were probably my favorite shows. And every week, we always discuss wrestling to some form, with the exception of, I think, two episodes in the last year. But we discuss wrestling, we discuss music, food. My God, Jeff, you and I both love food, and there's no secret there. But TV, movies, whatever it is, but it's that 80s thing that has really hooked me. And Jeff, I am about to break kayfabe and reveal something right now. That this is going to be a surprise because we've never discussed it. However, I have been writing a book for the last 2.5 years on new wave 80s music. And let this be the first time I've ever announced this publicly. And I want to say I am nearing completion after 2.5 years. And I've actually spoken to several new wave artists. I made a few connections last night because God knows I was trolling for phone numbers and email addresses. To continue this, but I'm real excited. And for me, last night was definitely something that I take to heart, because that's the music that I connect with. But at the same time, having this personal connection of writing this book over the last couple of years, and it's been slow going. I can tell you that, because it's, you know, there are times I think I'm making progress, and then I realize I'm not making any progress. And you've written two books, so you probably understand that. So I was really excited last night, and we were there. It was a 4-hour show, literally started at 8:30, ended at 12:30, and then we stuck around. We did the meet and greet. We got to meet Mike Score, who is the lead singer of Flock of Seagulls. And if you remember Flock of Seagulls, that was the guy that had the hair that looked kind of like a seagull's wings. And he was really, really personable. We joked that the last time I saw him in concert, both of us had hair, because he's bald as well. but a really friendly, personable guy. And I got to do it with my son, which, you know, I have tortured my son in some ways with this music through his entire life. So the fact that he got to be there with me and got to experience this and sang to every song and danced the entire night, and we were just there together. And, you know, it's a special moment. He's going off to college in a year, less than a year. So it's a really, you know, it's a really great bonding experience, father and son bonding experience at the same time, something that I'm super passionate about and something that he also loves. So it was a really, really special night. And when my son woke up today, and God bless him, because I was up at 7 and he woke up around noon. And he said, "So my reflections on last night." And I said, "Yeah, what were they?" He goes, I was blown away. He goes, "First off, the girl next to me was really hot," which, you know, that was, I liked the fact that he noticed that, obviously. But what he really liked about last night was the fact that everybody there was there to have a great time. So it wasn't like, you know, when you go to a concert and maybe you're paying $150 a ticket and there's different class levels and all that. Everybody was identical last night. The person next to me was me. You know, it was that. It was 1,000 people who were all there for literally the same thing. So it was a really special night and a night that I'm not soon ever going to forget.
Well, a couple things. First of all, yes, as a writer, I can definitely empathize with your what you were talking about how sometimes when you think you're about ready to get going, you kind of slow down again. And, you know, I found that when I was writing both my books, you would have moments of inspiration where you would knock off a couple chapters at a time, and then you let it sit, and you're sitting there and you're kind of cursing yourself for the fact you've let it sit, and then you get going again and boom, 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 you knock off a couple chapters. So I definitely can empathize with you there. Now, let me just say that you said something that kind of reminded me. You know, you said about your son going, and it's so cool that your son is able to sit and enjoy the music that that you were such a big fan of. And, you know, just today, my daughter, Kelly, posted a meme about her upcoming wedding. And it was something to the effect of, all those who were trying to figure out what sort of wedding gift to give me, I like concert tickets on the front row. And I thought that was kind of cute. And she then, after I had liked it, she said, "You know, you were the one that got me into this whole music thing." And it reminded me of our first concert that we went together when I took her to see the reunited Van Halen, complete with Wolfie on bass, unfortunately, instead of Michael. But, you know, it's really nice as my daughter is getting ready to get married here. It'll be like about 3 weeks from the date this comes out. And, you know, as I sat there and tried to figure out what song I was going to have for a father-daughter dance, I don't want to make it just the same old thing. So I've got something special that I will not be revealing. I will not be breaking kayfabe on that, Barry, because I'm going to surprise my daughter with a very special dance that is something that is definitely that her and I are a part of. It's something for the two of us. And since you will be in attendance, Mr. Rose, I thought that's what you were going to break kayfabe on, that you weren't coming to my daughter's wedding. But so you will get to see that. Now, speaking of that, and speaking of Van Halen, I would also like to say that I wanted to mention today, I have in fact finished, Barry, the Van Halen book, Running with the Devil. I talked about a couple weeks ago that I'd finished the Stevie Nicks book, Goldust Woman, which I liked. It was really good. But holy crap, Barry, I cannot encourage the listeners enough, any of you that are into Van Halen or hard rock or going to concerts, holy shit, Running with the Devil, the Van Halen story. It was written by, and I, of course, naturally didn't write the guy's name down, but he was their tour manager from about 77 through about 84, 85, right after the 1984 album came out. And it's got all the dirt you could ever want on David Lee Roth, Eddie Van Halen, Alex Van Halen, all of them. And yeah, definitely maybe changes some opinions you have on the Van Halen brothers, I can tell you that. But some really, really good stuff. Okay, now, Barry, before we continue, happen to see another thing on Facebook with a little short video. And I thought it was very interesting because it's somebody that you and I have talked about on this show before. It was a video somebody posted of an interview with Giancarlo Esposito, who is, of course, Gus Fring on Breaking Bad and on Better Call Saul. And he was retelling an experience about how he was on a flight one night And on this particular flight, he gets up to go to the bathroom, and there's a woman standing there waiting to go to the bathroom. And as he comes walking up, the woman looks at him, recognizes him, and has this look of object terror on her face, Barry. And she motions for him to go in front of her. And so he goes into the restroom on the plane. And as he comes out, the woman is standing there, and she just has this look of blind terror on her face. And he reaches his hand out, and he goes, "Hi, my name is Giancarlo. It's just a role that I play. I'm not really Gus." And the woman's face kind of relaxed, and she shook his head, and she kind of eased up, and they had a nice little conversation, which led me to this question for you, Barry Rose. We are all big TV fans. Barry, right off the top of your head, give me your favorite TV villains of all time.
Yeah, so actually, so number one is going to be John Lithgow, who was Arthur Mitchell on Dexter, on Showtime's Dexter. And it's probably going back about 10 years. And I believe it was season 4. He was mind-blowingly evil. And John Lithgow, who's a really good actor, he's kind of underrated. I think he's gotten pigeonholed between TV and comedy and things. But he was just absolutely frightening. He would absolutely go into that. Currently, I would say Giancarlo Esposito, which is a testament. You and I had also talked about this. It's a testament to his acting, because in real life, apparently, he's the nicest guy. He was on a TV show. He's done a whole bunch of TV shows, but he was on something on Fox many years ago, and I forget what it was called. I want to say it was a police comedy. He was in a Spike Lee movie. He's just a fun guy, but what an actor. He's tremendous. You know, Dexter to me actually had some amazing villains over the years. Peter Weller played a villain. There was a character named Lila, who was this British chick who was just smoking hot and crazy. So they've had some great ones. I'm trying to think who else would come into it. I don't know. And it is off the top of my head, and I'm a little groggy at the moment. Jeff, who would you say are some of the great villains that?
Well, right off the top of my head, I, of course, am a huge fan of the old HBO show Deadwood, and and Ian McShane played Al Swearengen on that show, and to me, he was just epic. Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, did we just break in? Joffrey, the evil boy king from Game of Thrones, who's played by an actor named Jack Gleason. What's interesting about Jack Gleason is as of now, he's retired from acting. He nailed that role so great that at 21, he figured, I'm never going to freaking top this again. And he retired from acting, which I think is just amazing. The other guy that came out, and I can't remember what the actor's name is, but the guy that played the cigarette smoking man X-Files.
He was great,
yeah,
too. Yeah.
I mean, just the way he could light a cigarette and just be the personification of evil was absolutely amazing. So
have you ever watched the television show Fargo? I believe it's on FX, if I'm correct. It's on
FX. I'm of course a big fan of the movie, and I've heard of the TV show. I've never watched it though.
So it's had two different seasons so far. The first season, two or three actually. It's again, I'm cloudy right now, but one, Billy Bob Thornton played a villain. He was tremendous. But the guy this last year who played the villain was the same guy from The Big Lebowski. He was what the hell was his name in The Big Lebowski? He was the videographer with the funny laugh. When they're over, Lebowski's over over Maude's house, and he's there.
Yes.
It's the same guy, and he played the heel. He played the villain in Fargo this past season, which was with Ewan McGregor. Was a very, very good season as well. That guy was just tremendous, pure evil and disgusting. The writing on that show is great because they gave him these really disgusting habits. There's been so many great villains over the years when you stop and think about it too.
And I want to give credit, the actor from the X-Files who played the cigarette smoking man was William B. Davis. And, he was very good. Speaking of evil, Barry, and speaking of the supernatural, we want to give another mention, of our sponsor, Ian Totten, his book, The House of Silver Doors. We got some great feedback on our message board. Ian has reached out to me to say that he's so overwhelmed by the response. And we want to encourage all of you that listen to this show or that are members of our board, which, by the way, Barry, we're getting close to 1,000 members there. We're doing pretty well. But Ian is a guy that is on our board. He's one of us. He is a listener. And I want to encourage you to reach out via Amazon, or you can ask him a question on our board. The House of Silver Doors, Barry, it's a novel in the genre of a Stephen King. If you're into that kind of supernatural stuff, Barry and I have taken a look at it. It looks like a great book, very compelling stuff, a little bit reminiscent of Salem's Lot and It, which are two of Stephen King's really great books that he's put out. And Barry, I know Ian is real happy, and we are so appreciative of his sponsorship of this show.
Yeah, we really are. We're really appreciative of people that actually patronize our sponsors, because, you know, it means a lot to us on a personal level. But, you know, at the same time, you know, authors and writers, they don't get rich. They're, you know, this is a lot of, it's a labor of love in a lot of cases. So, you know, Ian has written something that I think it bears that people should be reading it, because it's very interesting writing. It's very compelling, and he's telling a story. And for me, you know, the people that can write like that, to me, it's the greatest gift that you'll ever have. If you can sit down and you can put your mind in a place where you can come up with a story like that, that is the absolute greatest gift. So I'm super appreciative that Ian has chosen our show. You know, we didn't go to Ian. Actually, Ian kind of chose us, which I, you know, to me, I'm flattered. That's absolutely the most flattering thing of all time. But at the same time, too, that you know, I know that a couple of our members reached out to me and said, hey, I you know, what do you know about this book? Because I want to order it. You know, and I think that's absolutely great.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I was sitting there thinking about Ian and the way that he writes the book, you know, this is, folks, this isn't James Patterson or some, you know, author who has a book coming out every couple of months. This is a self-published author. And to me, you know, Barry and I, we did an episode about our favorite diners, you know. So instead of going to James Patterson, which is like going to Denny's, you're going to pick up a book by a writer who supports this podcast and our Facebook group. It's like going to your local diner. So you're supporting a locally, independently owned business. And that's why I go to those places, because I don't want to support IHOP or Denny's. I want to support the people that are locally based, that are trying to make a living, that are putting out quality products. And that's what Ian's doing. So round of applause for Ian and the work that he's doing. And we encourage everyone that listens to this show to check out his book, The House of Silver Doors. And it's available on Amazon. And if you need a link, reach out to Barry or I on our Facebook group, and we're happy to have it provided to you. So, Barry, now I think it's time that we go back into the history of Barry Rose. People are asking us about, tell us a little about yourselves. So we're going to get a glimpse into the childhood of Barry Rose and a night that he was taken to the auditorium or the convention center, Barry?
It was the convention center by that time. And I believe that was Brian Huff that actually asked that question.
Okay,
about our personal lives. But yes, it was the convention center, because they made the switch in 75. I want to say it was probably the second half of 75. They went from the auditorium to the convention center. And I'm not 100% sure why. I know the auditorium at that point kind of became a deal where they were doing more plays or musicals. I guess it was more cultural over in the auditorium. And the convention center, though, became the home for wrestling every Wednesday night. So, which was really my home base, because I started going in 71. I'm very vague on 71 to 73. Gets a lot better in 73, but by 75, you know, I remember every angle like it was yesterday. I can't remember what I did yesterday other than the concert, but I can tell you what happened with wrestling 41 years ago. You know, it's weird.
Okay, give us some context, Barry. Can you give us an approximate date of this show?
Yeah, it was in March of 1977, and it was really interesting. So I would have been 13 years old when this match took place.
And again, just for the listeners, I'm sorry to interrupt, it's Jumbo Tsuruta versus Billy Robinson. And this was a pretty big deal at the time. We had a lot of, dare I say, celebrities at ringside. Barry, why don't you tell the good folks about it?
Yeah, this was a huge deal. And I'll give you a little bit of the backstory on this, too. So Billy Robinson had been in the state from late 75 through the middle of 76. And he had been the Southern heavyweight champion. He had had a series of matches with Terry Funk over the NWA World's Heavyweight title, including one match that had a 90-minute time limit because they went to an hour draw in Tampa. That, to me right there, is a dream match. And unfortunately, they never wrestled. They wrestled in West Palm Beach, and they wrestled in Tampa, but they never wrestled in Miami Beach because that would have been the apex for me right there. But Billy actually had a history in Florida. He had been around for probably about 9 to 10 months, and I was actually the president of the Billy Robinson fan club. So back in those days, young marks like myself would start a fan club and become friendly with the wrestler. We would interview them. We would take photos, and then we would have members, and we would do a newsletter. And I published a newsletter that was a horrific piece of shit, to be brutally honest. But at the same time, my devotion and honesty were there because I was a huge fan of Billy Robinson, still my favorite wrestler to this day. So Billy had a history. Shiruta had no history whatsoever in Florida. We knew of him. And when I say we, the fans who were complete lunatic diehards that followed wrestling, we knew that he was a star in Japan. We didn't know much else about him, but we knew that he was a big deal there. So this was a big deal when it was happening because, you know, to have a championship match over a title, Giant Baba was there, Eddie Graham was there, Dory Funk Jr. was there, and they were all sitting ringside. And the other aspect, this was a 2 out of 3 falls match. Do you know how many times we had a 2 out of 3 falls match in Miami Beach? I'm going to say a dozen. It just never happened. And honestly, when I say a dozen, that was probably even pre-75. I don't recall this happening too much in the late 70s or early 80s. So the fact that you've got a title that's defended in Japan, it's a 2 out of 3 falls match, you've got all these dignitaries there. I mean, Eddie Graham in a jacket signifies he's not there for an angle. Dory Funk Jr. there, and Giant Baba there. And then you've got all the Japanese cameramen that were there. So we knew this was a big deal. And I didn't realize it until you walked in the building that night and you saw what the setup was. So this was, you know, and we were talking about the most important matches in the history of Miami Beach. And I'm going to say this is top three, top five. It's somewhere in that neighborhood. You referenced Ernie Ladd. I think you called me Ernie Ladd earlier. But you referenced Ernie Ladd. So, you know, yeah, the night that Ernie Ladd turned on Dusty was an absolutely huge moment in the history of wrestling for the state of Florida, but especially Miami Beach, because we didn't always get the big angles. The big angles generally occurred anywhere that was within driving distance of Tampa, because they would just bring the cameras, you know, whether it was Tampa or whether it was St. Pete or maybe Lakeland. It was a lot easier to lug the camera equipment than driving it all the way down 95 to come down to Miami. So we didn't get a lot of stuff that was happening and going to be filmed. So this was a big deal. The biggest event ever taking place in Miami Beach history as far as wrestling would be the night that Terry Funk won the NWA World's Heavyweight title in 75. So really, you know, These three matches all occurred within, you know, a year and a half, 2 years of each other, which is really, really cool. So it's a really good match, too. And, you know, I think before I had seen this match on YouTube, and I had seen it prior to you and I talking about it, I had built up in my head that it was maybe the greatest match or one of the greatest matches I ever saw live. And that was strictly going off of memory as a 13-year-old child. In hindsight, it's a very good match. I wouldn't call it one of the greatest matches I've ever seen. But it's also a look at Miami Beach in 1977 because, hey, you've got Frank Freeman, who was the venerable ring announcer for something like 20 to 25 years and also did the boxing announcing whenever they had boxing at the auditorium or convention center. And Frank was a staple in Miami Beach. And to be able to see him, you know, do the ring announcing, I don't know if there's any other footage of him out there where he does the ring announcing. So that was really, really cool to me. The dignitaries we just touched on, And Frenchie Bernard was the referee, and what a solid ref. You know, nobody ever talks about Frenchie Bernard. I think he's more well-known as being Andre's caretaker or somebody that was with Andre for years and then oversaw Andre's ranch property in the Carolinas. But he was a solid, solid referee, and he was a slight guy. He was maybe 130 pounds, maybe 140 pounds, you know, 5 foot. 7, maybe 5 foot 8 max, but real thin. But what a solid, believable referee. So this is a really solid match. I should say this was the last match that Billy Robinson ever had on Miami Beach. After his run, this was the last match, and he had been gone for maybe 6 months. So it was like he was, he was gone. He shows up, he has this match, and then he's gone, and he never comes back. Which, again, as a kid, is just fucking devastating. But this is a really solid match. Shiruta is very young here. He's very thin. Fantastic worker, though, and in working a different style than what you would see later in his career, where he was more hard hitting and maybe working a similar such style to King's Road, if not King's Road itself. But Shiruta, this is a 2 out of 3 falls match. It's for the UN heavyweight title, which was the United National title. Shiruta takes the first fall. It's a reverse belly-to-back suplex, and it's just a thing of beauty. I mean, Shiruta, Olympic wrestler, and you can see it. Does this suplex. It's fantastic. Robinson actually comes back and takes the second fall, and he does two of his one-arm backbreakers, and those backbreakers, they just look devastating. He was known for it, but he does two one-arm backbreakers followed by a Boston Crab, and when he gets that Boston Crab on Shiruta, he is leaning back. There is no, this is no half-ass Boston Crab. Shiruta, it looks like he's being bent in half, legitimately. One thing this really took me back is, as I look around, it's very cathartic in a sense to watch a match like this. Because, again, I'm going back to my childhood, but I'm able to see everybody at ringside because they focus in on all the ringsiders. And, there's the married couple. I believe her name was Diana Behrensfeld, and there's her husband, who I saw week after week. And there's the lady with the whistle. And, my God, did that whistle drive me crazy at the time. But I don't know if I could handle it now. Like, if I had to go see wrestling and somebody just sat there and blew a whistle all night, I would probably just lose it on her. But there she is. She's dressed in yellow. She's blowing her whistle. You don't see her husband, but her husband was this guy that would wear – he was kind of like – I'm trying to find somebody to equate it with. But he would wear these silk shirts with these cool patterns. He was kind of like this funky hipster of the 70s, but he was probably in his 50s. Or maybe even early 60s, but yet he was this cool-dressed motherfucker. So that was kind of cool. So I like this match a lot. I would give this match, if I'm putting it on a 1 to 4 stars, up until the ending, which I'll get to in a second, I would give this match probably 3 stars, maybe even 3.5 stars, 3.25 stars. It's a really good match. There's not a lot that's wrong with this match, and they give them plenty of time to tell a story. But there's a screw job ending at the end, and it's just it's bizarre to me. Abdullah the Butcher, who had wrestled earlier in the night. Now, this was another thing. Abdullah wasn't a regular in Florida. This was a one-off, and he wrestled a guy named El Gaucho, who was Juan Sebastian, who was an old journeyman wrestler and maybe one of my favorite prelim workers ever. And Abdullah comes in, kicks Frenchie Bernard in the head, attacks Shiruta, throws him outside the ring, and then he and Robinson get into it. And Robinson is laying him out. Abdullah reaches into his trunks, pulls out a pencil, jabs Robinson in the throat, gets out of the ring. Shiruta comes in, nails Robinson with the drop kick. 1, 2, 3. We have a brand new UN champion. And as a kid, I sat there and I just remember being devastated. Like, my hero just got beat. And a one-off, it was one of these things that just, it played hell with me, and I absolutely hated it. In hindsight, I watched the match, and having Abdullah come in, it hurts the match. I believe it was furthering a storyline in Japan between Abdullah and Robinson, and it was giving Robinson, I guess, an out where it wasn't a clean pinfall. But at the same time, if I look at it with different eyes, it goes, yeah, this is a, you've got two of the best technical wrestlers in the world, and it gets ruined by a guy coming in jabbing another guy with a pencil. So it, to me, it just completely just threw it off. But it was a big night in Miami Beach. And, you know, and as a kid, you know, wrestling was everything. You know, we growing, you and I have talked about this, but growing up in Florida, we didn't have a lot of professional sports. We had the Miami Dolphins, thank God. And for a couple of years, we had the ABA, where they, you know, we had the Miami Floridians, and then we had college sports, but we didn't have pro sports. And really, professional wrestling was, quote unquote, our professional sport. It was a constant every Wednesday night. And every Wednesday night, you know, anywhere between 3,500 to 5,500 people would show up, and they would just lose their shit, you know, for 3 hours, and it would happen. And so it was a big deal. So being able to see this match and to be being able to watch, you know, what's essentially, it's almost a home movie. It's like, there's your childhood. You know, there it is. It's all right there. It's a really, really big deal. So I'm grateful for the opportunity that, A, I got to see it again, and B, that we even got to discuss it on our show.
Yeah, it's a really interesting match, and like you say, a lot of what makes it interesting is just seeing the characters at ringside. I did not have the opportunity to go to Miami Beach in the 70s. I went to Fort Lauderdale to the Armory on a few occasions, but my home base was I would drive up to West Palm Beach to the auditorium in the early 80s, and I must have hit that about 30 or 40 times during about a 2 or 3 year period. So but no, and you know, one thing, it's funny when you talk about Abdullah the Butcher comes running in, and everyone now has this mental picture of what Abdullah the Butcher was in the late 80s and the 90s, this guy that was over 4 bills. This is more of a slim down Abdullah the Butcher. He is probably 300, but it's not much over 300. So he's much smaller than he became later. But it definitely takes away from the finish of the match, because both guys are working such a strong style. And it would have been nice if they could have had some sort of definitive finish to the match. But you understand, of course, the politics that goes into not only wrestling here in the United States, but into Japan. And, you know, the funny thing, truth in advertising here, folks, originally what we were going to do is we were going to do a Jumbo Tsuruta Billy Robinson match from 1984 when Jumbo had the belt. There is a match that's out there, I believe, I want to say it's from Green Bay. And but by that point, you can really see the aging of Billy Robinson. He had kind of this curly perm, and he had this porno mustache, and his body had started to sag. So it was a much older Billy Robinson. And I thought this match, until the goofy run-in by Abdullah, was a much stronger match. I think you'd agree with that, Barry.
Yeah, it was too, and I like that match as well. There's some highlights out there. If you look on YouTube, there is a Billy Robinson compilation of his moves, and it's him in his prime too, which is the guy just to me was astounding. But I got to say too, is kind of an addendum to what we've been talking about. So the last time I saw Billy Robinson was in 1977, and he was a nice, you know, so there was a Billy Robinson had a reputation of A, that he could be torturous in the ring, he could take liberties with guys in the ring if he didn't respect them, but that he could be rude to fans as well. And I remember going to the WFIA conventions, and, you know, people would say, oh, you're the president of his fan club. Oh, he's a dick. You know, he's mean to us and he's rude to us. And I would always get, especially as a kid, I would get very defensive about it because I never experienced that. And I never did experience that. So the last time I saw him was 1977, and I did not see him again until I believe it was 2009. So it was literally over 30 years later. And Pete Lederberg, was coming up, and he was working. He was selling photographs at a Legends Fan Fest up in New Jersey. And he said, "Hey, I'm going to be in Jersey. It's like an hour from you. Do you want to come?" And I said, "I'll do my best. It's on a Saturday or a Friday night." And I said, "Yeah, I really would like to." He goes, "Billy Robinson's going to be there." So at that point, I made sure that I was there. So I showed up. And Saturday, I showed up Friday night, but Saturday Billy was there, and I walked over to him. And again, I hadn't seen him in 32 years, and I certainly don't look anything like I did, you know, 32 years ago. And I had a photo of the two of us that was taken in 1976. I think I was 12 when this photo was taken. And I put the photo in front of him, and he looks at it, and he looks at me and goes, Barry, what happened to your hair? Just like that. And I got to tell you, I got goosebumps when it happened, because first off, you know, how do you remember my name? You know, that granted, you know, we were friendly and you knew my dad and I ran your fan club, but 32 years later, I was a kid. How do you, you know, I was blown away. So I showed him the photo, and then we took a photo, and I'll post this in the group too. So it's the photo of us with each other holding the original photo. And it's a really poignant moment. And we got to speak, and we talked for about 20 minutes. He asked me about my dad, and he told me how fortunate, you know, you'd never have to tell me how fortunate I was to have a father like I had, but he told me how fortunate I was and how much he enjoyed the time that he spent with us, you know, and it was a little thing for him to say that just meant the world to me. And we exchanged phone numbers. He said he was going to be in Philadelphia. He was doing something, or in New Jersey. He was doing something, some sort of seminar, and we would get together for dinner. And we had a phone call, and then I never spoke to him again, and then he died. And I got to admit, the morning I found out he died, and I remember exactly where it was, I was home, and I pulled up the computer, and his son announced that Billy had passed. I broke out in tears. And, you know, it's not like I cry every day, but at the same time, I think there was such a rush of emotion in finding out that somebody that had been kind of a childhood idol to me and that had been so good to me, you know, it really meant a lot. So I was sad that I never got, I invited him over to the house for dinner and stuff. And I never got to go through with that because he passed away. But I was so grateful for the opportunity that I got to see him just one last time after 30 something years, and to have that conversation. You know, it's just something I would never, ever forget in my entire life.
Yeah, that's awesome, Barry. No question about it. So, and you know, you had the chance that night to see, one of the idols and legends of your youth. And recently, since we're done talking about this match, one of the legends in Barry's mind of his adult life, Jumbo Tsuruta, we actually had a chance, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, to speak to the youngest son of Jumbo Tsuruta, Yuji Tsuruta. And we thought you guys might like to take a listen to what Yuji had to say about his father's life, his father's legacy, and a little bit about some music and movies that he might be interested in too. So let's throw it to our interview with Yuji Tsuruta. Okay, on this special one-year anniversary edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry, we are honored to have joining us all the way from Japan, Mr. Yuji Tsuruta. Barry, what do you think? Do you think he might be related to someone that you're a big fan of and that I'm a big fan of?
I think there might be a chance with that too. So we're really excited about this, by the way. This is, Yuji, I should ask too, Yuji, have you ever listened to our podcast, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry?
You know, I haven't, but I wish I had.
There you go. Exactly. So, yeah. Jeff and I are both absolutely huge fans of your dad's work. And I know Jeff is, Jeff mentioned this to me a couple of weeks back. We're super excited that you're here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here, too.
So, okay, let's get started discussing your father, if that's okay with you. So tell me, but let's get to the bad news first. When your father passed rather young, how old exactly were you when your father passed away?
I was in Oregon. I was eighth grade, so I was 14.
Okay, and your father was working as a teacher there, correct?
Yes, he was working for Portland State University. And he was going to be teaching at USC in California.
Okay. Yeah. So 14 years old, you still, I'm assuming, still have some pretty active memories of your father's wrestling career, correct?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So what, as a young man who saw his father as a legend in Japanese professional wrestling, as Jumbo Tsuruta's son, but as a wrestling fan, what are your favorite memories of your father as a pro wrestler?
As a pro wrestler, my favorite match that I saw on TV was him against Bruiser Brody, and that was in 1988. So I was like 2 years old. I was born in 1986, but I remember watching the first match that I watched was against Dory Funk Jr. And I don't think I was even one years old, but my father turned on a TV for me and they were discussing something. They just turned on the TV and like I saw my father on TV and in the living room. And I remember that. That was one of my fond memories. But like my favorite memory must be like one of the matches that I saw live against Mitsuharu Misawa. And he did this 3 belly to back suplex in a row. And the whole crowd was so, you know, loud and energetic. That was in Japan, Yokohama. And I think that's the best memory I have of watching him as a pro wrestler. Yeah.
Okay. So at what age, you know, you say you watched your father from a very early age. At what age did you suddenly realize you're going to school and your friends realize that you're the son of Jumbo Tsuruta? When does it strike you that your father is a relatively famous figure in your country?
Well, I didn't know he was a wrestler for a long time. Like maybe when I was 2 years, I used to go to this drinking party with my father and my mom. And like there would be like a bunch of people in red jerseys, right? And I didn't know they were working for my father's company. I didn't know he was a wrestler. But one of the wrestlers came up to me and he was trying to talk with me. But I was really young, so like I could only speak a few words. But he said to me, his name was Masanobu Fuchi. He's one of my father's good friends. And he came up to me and he said, did you know that your father is a pro wrestler? And I said, I didn't. And I asked I asked him how strong he was as a wrestler. And he said he was the best, you know. So that's the time when I realized and started thinking that my father is a wrestler, you know, sports athlete. I didn't think he was going to be a best in the world. You know, I didn't take my imagination there yet. So, yeah, that happened long time ago.
Okay, Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Yuji, so you just mentioned that, you know, your favorite match is the match of your dad versus Bruiser Brody. Did your father have a favorite opponent that he liked to work with?
He had an interview back in 1991, I think, and he listed 5 rivalries that he had against his career at that point. And names were Stan Hansen, Nick Bockwinkel, Bruiser Brody, Genichiro Tenryu, and Mitsuharu Misawa. So I think those 5 were the most influential wrestlers for him as a rival, I think, as rivals.
Wow. So Jeff, did you ever get to see Jumbo Tsuruta live?
I actually did. Yuji, I went over in 1987 for the All Japan Tag Team Tournament in December. And I got to see your father teaming with Yoshiaki Yatsu, I believe, at that time.
Great, yeah. You know, who were they wrestling against?
Oh, I actually saw about 5 nights of the tournament. So I saw them, I believe, wrestle Hansen and Gordy. I don't think I saw them wrestle Brody and Snuka, but they might have wrestled Tenryu and Ashurahara.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, so many, many, many great teams. So, well, let me ask you this. One of the names that's not mentioned that I had been a fan of, did your father have an opinion on Riki Choshu when Riki Choshu was wrestling for All Japan? Do you know?
I have never heard about Riki Choshu from my father directly, but it's, you know, fan favorite, that match and the rivalry against Yatsu and Riki Choshu. All I heard was like there was a 60-minute draw. I saw the match, of course, but after the match, my father went drinking, you know. But Riki Choshu just like gave up and like he was very tired. That's what I heard. Like, but most fans realize how great my father was as a wrestler. By the 60-minute draw match, you know, he could convince fans that he was a better wrestler by not winning even, you know. So I think that was a great thing about their rivalries. Yeah.
Sure. So let me ask you a question. As you've, you know, on the Facebook page that I follow of Classic Japanese History, where you post a lot of memories of your father, whether it be a match that's on YouTube or another channel, you've done obviously a great deal of research on your father's career, and your father was involved in the 1972 Olympics in Munich. Did you ever discuss your father's amateur career with him?
I used to wrestle too when I was in middle school and high school. So like I asked him for a few advices when I was on the wrestling team in Oregon. And I remember like talking to him on the phone, and I asked him like, how should I defend myself in wrestling? And he said, offense is the best defense. And another thing I asked him was like, what's the best advice you can give me when I'm wrestling? And he said, the most important aspect of wrestling is your weight shifting. So I remember that. But he didn't, really talk much about, the sport or anything even. And he didn't talk much. He was very silent about most things, but it was very nice. And as a Greco-Roman wrestler, he went to the Olympic, of course. And I heard from my mother that he doesn't usually keep things that he won, like trophies and whatnot. But like he kept his jacket that he wore as a Japanese national team. And he wore a red jacket, and I remember my mom telling me about how he really was fond of that jacket.
Sure, and he was obviously very proud to have represented his country. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So then he gets started. Giant Baba, from what I understand, had been scouting him, and Giant Baba, he started wrestling with Giant Baba's company. He goes over to the United States. Now, has he ever did he ever discuss as you were getting older, before he passed away, the early part of his career when he wrestled in Texas? Or is that something that you strictly learned about from doing your own personal research?
Are you talking about the relationship between my father and Giant Baba?
Yes, correct.
I knew about these things before I started researching, but, and I've met with, Mr. Giant Baba long time ago. And he, I remember him passing away on my birthday. But there was not many times that I've met with Mr. Giant Baba, but I felt like I wasn't supposed to associate much with the company, you know, because it was his job, obviously, you know, and I was a little kid, so. But
so he wanted to kind of keep a separation of his family from the business.
Yes, he didn't talk much about the wrestling, but. I know that if I did ask him a question, he would answer, you know, but I didn't. Well, there's not much I want to say. I did mention that he used to always ask me who my favorite wrestler was, you know, and I would always answer Jumbo Tsuruta, you know,
But, that was a smart answer.
One time I answered Misawa, and he got really upset. I remember that. So I would never do that.
Gotcha. Well, so I only had the opportunity to see your father live a couple of times, and it was when he was in the state of Florida. But I was ringside in 1977 when he wrestled Billy Robinson on Miami Beach. Have you ever seen that match on YouTube?
Yeah, I saw it first time when I was in middle school as a 10 ordeal match that my father had against the wrestling legends who were outside Japan. And I remember watching Billy Robinson, when I was 15 or so, 14, yeah.
Yeah, and Billy Robinson probably my favorite wrestler of all time. Your father is in the top three, so he's right there. But it was a really good match. I hated the ending with Abdullah the Butcher running in. But what did your father think of Billy Robinson? Did he ever say anything about it?
No, he didn't. I mean, he never mentioned, but I knew of him, that he was, you know, because I remember I'm recognizing him when I saw him first time on the video. So I saw him somewhere, and
Do you think your father, with his own personal background, where he represents his country in the Olympics, do you think he had more of an affinity to wrestling guys that had legitimate background, whether it's in in amateur wrestling or something along those lines, as opposed to someone who just picked up the sport, you know, got involved and, you know, may have like been a sumo wrestler? Did he prefer someone who had an amateur background?
Well, like, I don't know how his mentality was formed, but I know that there's a quote that he had against Hulk Hogan, that he didn't want to wrestle Hulk Hogan because he was in the movies. He was doing business with movie people.
Sure.
So I don't know how his mentality were, but if he sees a fan, and if they, want to shake his hands or something, he would always have them in a headlock. So, like, he didn't mind. Yeah, but they had to be associated with All Japan Pro Wrestling, and they have to go through all this. But I think he really enjoyed wrestling against wrestlers like Dory Funk or technical wrestlers.
Sure.
But I don't think he had preference. But I just know that I heard it from my mother that if there was a wrestler who a bad wrestler, it's dangerous for both wrestlers. So like he tries to end the wrestling match really quick. That's what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely too. So with your father too, there was a definite, separation of style. So when he's wrestling a guy like Billy Robinson, it's much more of, let's say, a scientific or a technical wrestling match. Mm-hmm. And then he wrestles a guy like Brody, where it's much more stiff, it's much more hard-hitting. Did your father have a preference? And that was kind of what Jeff was alluding to as well when Jeff was talking about, would your father have enjoyed wrestling somebody who was more of a wrestler, per se, as opposed to maybe a worker?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a quote by my father that he said he can adjust to depending on wrestlers that he going against. He can wrestle against Dory Funk or Billy Robinson, on the ground, technically, and he can go against Tendu or Brody or the Road Warriors and hard hitting stiff matches. He can do that. He described his style as something that he can change throughout his career. I mean, look at his style in the 80s and 70s and 90s. It's all different,
He can adjust.
Yeah, he can adjust. Yeah, he adjusts his wrestling style depending on the opponent. That's what he said, yes.
Yeah. So one of the guys that you mentioned, for whatever reason, it kind of surprised me, but now that I think about it, it really shouldn't have surprised me, is Nick Bockwinkel. And that is a guy that can also work many different styles and do it just and look like a complete champion doing it. Your dad obviously had a great affinity and respect for Nick Bockwinkel.
Yes, yes. I saw a few matches against Yamatsuda and Nick Bockwinkel, and it was one of those opponents where it was very hard to win a belt from. And I think it matters that he won his AWA heavyweight championship from him at the time of his career. Yeah.
And he was, of course, the first Japanese wrestler to win a world championship and actually come to the United States and defend it on the United States soil, which speaks a lot to the promoters and what they thought of your father and, the credibility that he gave the title.
Yes. Yes. I think it matters to a lot of fans that he circuited for 6 months in America and came back to Japan with a belt and he went back to America. I think that means a lot to many fans and to my father too, as well.
Yeah. So your father, I guess you said you were born in 86.
Yes.
Gotcha. So you weren't at that stage. You really weren't aware that your father was the AWA World's Heavyweight Champion. Did your dad have any good memories of working in the United States, defending the title? Anything that he ever shared?
Yeah, he didn't talk much about wrestling in America, and he didn't wrestle much after I was born in America. Like I don't remember him going abroad, but I know that he always liked America. We would go to Hawaii every year, every summer. So, like, I know that he was very, I know that he really liked, going on a jet and going to America.
Well, you mentioned that he was teaching in Portland, as we discussed at the very beginning of the interview. Did he like living in Portland and in that part of the country?
Yeah, we loved it. Yeah, that was one of the best time I had in my life. Oregon was, there's his friend named Mati Suzuki. He used to wrestle for Ricky Dozo.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. I've heard the name.
He lives in Oregon. He was a bodybuilder, and he was also a wrestler. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why we went to Oregon. And another reason is because we want to practice, we want to study English. And of course, him, he wanted to continue his research. But being on the countryside really was very much fun. Yeah.
Well, you just mentioned a name too, Matty Suzuki, which is a name that I haven't heard. He was a wrestler in the U.S. in the 60s and I guess the first half of the 1970s. And I was just, I think I posted something on Facebook a week or two ago, whatever happened to Matty Suzuki, because it's a name that I haven't heard. So he's a bodybuilder living in Portland?
He was a wrestler. I don't know what he's doing right now. I haven't contacted him in a long time, but he used to be an athlete, yes. And he took care of us, the family, and we were communicating a lot. And he gave us a lot of tips to live in Oregon.
To transition to the United States.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is a hypothetical question. If your father was still alive, what do you think he would be doing? Would he be involved in professional wrestling or would he have stepped away at this point?
I have no idea about what he would be doing if he was alive because, I didn't know he was going to retire right after Mr. Jan Baba's passing. Many fans believe that the reason why he didn't inherit All Japan Pro Wrestling, become All Japan Pro Wrestling's president, is because he saw many things that Mr. Jan Baba had to go through as a president and as a wrestler, you know, and he didn't feel that it was appealing to him. But he wanted to teach and he wanted to continue his research in America, USC. So he's going to be involved in the sports, of course. But I don't know how he would be associating with the business.
Do you think he would have been associating with amateur wrestling, perhaps, over in Japan?
Yeah, the reason why he became a professional wrestling was because there was a guy who was the top of the wrestling association in Japan, said to him that if you become a pro wrestler, amateur wrestling will become popular too. There's a possibility that amateur wrestling will bloom, their business would, you know, and that was one of the quotes that made him convince himself that he should become a pro wrestler.
Sure.
So very much, yeah.
Sure. So we've mentioned the name Giant Baba before, Shoei Baba. Tell me, from what you've known personally and from what you've learned in your research of your father, just the level of respect that there was in the relationship between your father and Giant Baba.
Well, he was a very big figure in Japan. Like, everybody knows who he was. And my father never won a match against Giant Baba. And even though some fans claim that he could have, but he never did. I think that means much to him that he never tried to win against the president, you know? And Tenryu did, and other few others did, maybe Brodie or Hansen. There was no true attempt when he was in his prime. So, and as a person, like, I met him, he's a very big guy. He's a 6'11", very big. And even though I was a little kid, like, I could tell, like, he was a lot bigger than my father. And I heard that that my father learned a lot of things about business and wrestling and life from Mr. Jan Baba. So, I have tremendous respect towards him. And
Do you think your father, and whether he actually came out and said this to you or not, but inside, do you think your father resented the fact that Baba never put him over?
No, I don't believe that. No.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
I thought that's the way you were going there, and I just wanted to ask you about that. So
in 1983, when he won against Brodie, the belt, international belt, Mr. Jan Baba came up to him I heard this is a story I heard that Kim, he told my father that he's going to be the ace of All Japan Pro Wrestling from now. So he knew that he was the best wrestler. It's just part of the business that he was trying to do, trying to achieve by not, you know, winning against him. Yeah.
So Barry, you were going to ask something?
Yeah, so you just mentioned the name of Tenryu, and I got to admit, the matches that your father had with Tenryu in their tag team were just phenomenal. Do you have any have you been in contact with Tenryu since your father passed?
Yeah, I went and shook his hand. He almost chopped my head off afterwards, but yeah, that was scary. But I met with his daughter. We're in the same generation, so like we started talking. And, yeah, she asked me if I wanted to meet her father. And when he came to Osaka, when I was living in Kobe at the time, I went and saw him. It was very nice. He was, it was the first time I met him. Cause the rivalries have already began when I was a little kid, maybe when I was two. Like, the rivalry between my father and Tenryu. So, talking to him was very, very fun.
Yeah, let me ask you a question that I've always kind of wondered. So the story goes that when Misawa had begun to attract enough of a following, had developed enough as a singles wrestler to where he was getting matches against your father, and your father was winning, but Misawa was growing as a competitor, and perhaps Baba could see that, you know, eventually that Misawa would replace your father as the new ace. And the story goes that one night when your father is talking to a Giant Baba, or he gets the message saying that he gets the feel for the crowd, and he says, tonight Misawa wins. And your father sends a note back saying, you mean like a count out? And he goes, no, pin. And then your father puts Misawa over, makes Misawa the ace. Mm-hmm. Was your father okay with that, or do you think it upset your father?
Well, it upset me when I saw that.
Well, of course, I'm sure.
One of the mats that I hate the most. That's the story I heard, but like I kind of remember like making that up in my head, because there were so many people bugging me about how wrestling was fake, and I remember thinking to myself, what if, you know, this was all made up, you know, after he lost, you know? And I remember like, that's the story. That would have been possible. I remember that, but I never like told anybody about the story.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, he had the phone call and like asked Mr. Baba whether it could be a draw, and he said no, and that was it. I remember talking to my father and my mom about Tiger Mask Second, you know, and I like Tiger Mask Second, and you know, they would always play, oh, Mr. Misawa, you know, and I was like, I don't want to know the guy, you know, behind the mask, you know. But so I knew he was around, and I met him when he was a Tiger Mask. But he didn't have his elbow smash then. So I know that Dory Funk taught my father the elbow smash, and my father taught Misawa the elbow smash, you know. And his elbow smash became this big news that almost made my father's hearing go out. You know, and I know that his popularity was gaining, and he did lose against his single match, but Misawa never won against my father when for a triple crown, right? And
yes.
So as a whole record, there's this myth that Misawa is going to become this whole new ace of all Japan. But there was Stan Hansen, there was Terry Gordy, there was Steve Williams, you know, there was a lot of wrestlers that was still in Misawa's way, even if he was he won against my father, you know, and there was Kobashi, and there's all, you know, Tawe and Kawana. So, there was a lot of things that people believed in back then, but I never thought that, truly that, Misawa had a legit chance to become an ace until my father became sick in bed. Yeah.
Sure. So let me ask you, you mentioned that, Misawa, when you talked about your favorite opponents of your father, and you mentioned that you at one point you told your father that Misawa was your favorite wrestler and he didn't like that.
Yeah.
So of all the what they call the four pillars, you had Misawa, Taue, Kawada, and Kobashi. Was Misawa your favorite of those four?
Yeah, mainly because, you know, back then, like, all these wrestlers, including Tenryu and Yatsu, were scary to kids and people my age, right? And mm-hmm. Misawa and all these Kobashi, and they seem like babyface, you know? And,
sure.
I wasn't that aware of the fact that they were going to rebel against my father's team. So, like, you know, and he seemed like, and I know that they trained together. I met with Mr. Kobashi and Mr. Akiyama when he was training. I remember thinking to them myself, these were really nice people, you know? So that's, sure. And Misawa was always around, and I met him when I was Tiger Mask, so I really liked him. So, yeah, that's the reason why I said to him that, excluding the fact that I really like my father the best, because he kept asking me, you know? So I had to say, you know, I like Misawa the second, but I don't think he got it. Yeah.
Barry, you wanted to ask us a question?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So one of the things on our podcast is we discuss other things than professional wrestling. We discuss, it's breaking kayfabe, as Jeff always says. Jeff, do you want to do it?
We I'm break kayfabe on life, Yuji.
On life. But we break
not just the wrestling business.
Yeah, so we talk about music. We talk about movies. We talk about food. We talk mm-hmm. about everything. Is there? I know that you're into music, and because you and I have been Facebook friends for a couple of years, you're always quoting lyrics from music and songs. So, your opinion, greatest rock and roll guitarist of all time?
Guitarist? Oh, Kurt Cobain, maybe?
You're a huge Nirvana fan, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that too. So my next question, and I'm going to keep rolling with this, do you watch movies? Do you see a lot of movies?
Yeah, I was a film major in Los Angeles. University.
Oh, who's your favorite movie director?
Steven Spielberg.
Wow, there you go. So what is your favorite Spielberg movie?
I want to say E.T., but it's Jurassic Park.
Wow, which is, I think it just was just an anniversary for Jurassic Park or something, because I know it was re-released in theaters. What about Quentin Tarantino? Are you a fan of Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah, I love the Quentin Tarantino movies, yeah. Gotcha.
What's your? Because I just before we came on the air, I was watching Kill Bill Kill Bill Volume 1 for probably the 50th time this past year. It's been on cable a lot, and it's such a spectacular movie. But I honestly think I don't think Quentin Tarantino has ever had a bad movie. I like the way that he directs. I like his style of movie. What's your favorite Tarantino movie?
Pulp Fiction. Yeah, hands down. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Tarantino's great and I love him, but I gotta put Spielberg on the top. But I love this movie director called Paul Thomas Anderson, who's a friend of Quentin Tarantino. And I have his group going on the Facebook too, and the group. But as a writer, I respect Tarantino a whole lot, but I got very much influenced by Paul Thomas Anderson. Yeah. He did a movie called Boogie Nights. Yeah.
I'll just point out, Yuji, that when I first in college took a film as literature course, I've mentioned this in the podcast. That's where I was first introduced to Akira Kurosawa.
Oh yeah. Okay. He's great. Yeah.
So yeah. And my favorite Kurosawa film is one of his more, I guess you could say minor films, a movie I believe called High and Low. Have you ever seen that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw it.
Yeah. That's a great film.
Yeah. So. I asked my father who the best director in the world was. And he said Steven Spielberg. And I asked him, the best, well, his favorite movie, and he said Pretty Woman. So I said,
Pretty Woman.
Yeah, so I gave him a look, and he's Gone with the Wind. So, okay. And then I asked him what the best Japanese film was, and he answered with Kurosawa's film, one of the Kurosawa's film called Ikiru. So it's one of his movie, drama movie that he made when he was 1950s. It's a very good one.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Yuji, I'm going to put you on the spot right now. The best Patrick Swayze movie, is it Roadhouse or Point Break?
Point Break.
What?
There you go.
I've only seen Point Break.
I think we've got an answer to that question, because it has been established in our podcast, Yuji, that Barry's two favorite human beings of all time are Patrick Swayze and your father.
That's true.
And as a matter of fact, As a matter of fact, this week, when we download the episode featuring this interview with you, we will also be reviewing one of your father's matches against Billy Robinson.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, listen, Yuji, we're going to wrap it up here. We want to tell you how much we really appreciate you going above and beyond the call of duty. We know you, we're sending this across the Pacific Ocean, and you got up a little bit early to talk about your father and his career with you. And we really do appreciate it. It is our 1 year anniversary of our podcast, and you have made it a very special one. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we really want to thank Yuji. That was a great interview, Barry, and he was such a nice guy, and he was so giving to he actually got up early because at the time we interviewed him, I think it was about 8 o'clock for us, and it was about 7 a.m. for him over in Japan. So we really do appreciate Yuji taking time out of his day.
Yeah, that was awesome, too, and I love the fact that Yuji was very open about his father, too, which I think is great, and we learned some new things. But the fact that we could talk movies, you know, we can talk music and things, I'd love to have Yuji back on and maybe talk about food next time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, Barry, now it is that time after one solid year for me to look back. We've talked many times. I don't think we've gone through the whole list yet, Barry, but we've included a great deal of the matches that I picked as the top 100 matches of the decade of the 1980s. And now it is time for us to discuss numero uno, the match that I picked as the greatest match of the decade. Took place on May 8th, 1989 in Nashville, Tennessee, as Ric Flair is facing Ricky Steamboat, his last chance, they said, to win the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Barry, you had a chance to watch this recently. Tell me whether or not you think this one still holds up.
Oh, I mean, absolutely, too. I don't think, you know, so the trilogy, which it's taken on legendary status by this point, the trilogy of matches between Flair and Steamboat from 1989 is universally regarded in America as maybe the greatest three series of matches. You know, even currently, people still talk about this, and these matches are still revered. And this is a tremendous match. And you know, every one of their matches were absolutely fantastic. They at the time, and again, we can look at it in hindsight. Maybe you can pick it apart and say this and do that, you know. But at the time when these matches were taking place, we were well aware that we were seeing something historical. These matches are quote unquote flawless. This is exactly what professional wrestling at the time was supposed to be, and it's head and shoulders above just literally everything else that was being presented. So it certainly holds up. It holds up to this day. These matches will hold up 100 years from now. You know, this is the kind of thing that I think, you know, and that's something I think about. I don't know why I think about shit like that, Jeff, but maybe you can tell me why I do. But I think about, so what's going to happen to the fact that, you know, we really can't go back and look at wrestling from 100 years ago. But in 100 years from now, they're going to be able to see all the stuff we were seeing. You know, what are they going to say? And what is professional wrestling going to be like in 100 years? But this is a tremendous match. And you voted it number one. I'm not going to say it's not number one, because it certainly may deserve to be number one. I'm not sure if I like this match better than the other two, with the exception of the angle that occurs at the end, because that right there is mind-blowing, because it caught me off guard. I did not know that was going to happen, and it certainly was, you know, considering what a huge fan I am of Terry Funk's work. But so this match, you know, this match is fantastic too. And this was from Wrestle War in 89 that took place in Nashville. And funny, Steamboat's favorite match, I did a little research just to pull this up as well. Pardon me. I feel like we can talk about this match, but at the same time, I don't know if I'm going to say anything new about this match. So I pulled up some shit, and this was the Steamboat's favorite match was the second match, the one that took place in New Orleans. And Flair just thought the opposite. Flair thought that the New Orleans match was okay, but he didn't think it was that good. And I think a lot of it rested on the crowd. He felt the crowd was brutal. However, Steamboat, this match is last on his list of the three. for whatever the reason, and I'm going to quote him on this, it was still a great match, but Flair and I had worked with each other so many times in the Carolinas that there were matches on just regular shows that would have blown that one away, or all three of them, even the New Orleans match. I'm talking about stuff that was never televised or taped. I would have liked for that night in Nashville to have been a one-hour draw, but honestly, I don't remember expressing my opinion that I wanted to leave it to the judges' scorecard, go that route, and maybe end up with a split decision. I always thought there would be a fourth, and I always thought that. I sort of took it for granted. I was the current champion, and if he won the championship back, then I'm going to try to get it back. But that never took place because of the outcome of my match, and that was a very sincere letdown. So that's a really poignant comment from Steamboat, who's a very genuine guy, obviously. You've met him, and you know it. You know, WWE.com actually asked Ric Flair, where does he rank Steamboat as his great, you know, great opponent? And he said he's number one for sure. So I just think that's really, there's such a respect there between the two guys, knowing that they've created something. And, you know, and it's obvious that, you know, it wasn't just two guys going out. It was two guys going forth wanting to have the best matches possible, and in so they were able to do it. So I'm going to let you take what happens after the end of the match. Flair has won. He pins Steamboat. They give him the title, and Jim Ross. And Jim Ross at this stage in 89, my God, what a talent. Just absolutely fantastic. Jim Ross is doing an interview with Ric Flair in the middle of the ring, Jeff, and I hand this over to you now.
Well, before I get to that, there's a couple other things I want to mention. There were some things about this match that I thought were just letter perfect, but there were things about the match that I really didn't like, and I'm going to address both. You know, at the time this match took place, Ric Flair, 40 years old, Ricky Steamboat was 36. And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, you think about like an athlete that's a professional football player. They're way past their prime if they're an NFL player or a baseball player. But here you have two guys who are really at the pinnacle of their careers. You know, I almost said the penultimate, but of course we found out over the course of the year that that's not the correct way to say it. But these guys are definitely at the pinnacle of their career. So the intro to the match, we got Ric Flair again, and we've spoken about this when we talked about the other two in the series, the ladies man versus the family man. And good Lord, who is going to boo the guy coming out with the 40 women, the 40 models that they've hired? And I couldn't help but think, Barry, as I'm watching this, here you've got the NWA, WCW, whatever you want to call it, that is a complete and utter clusterfuck at this point in May of 1989 because of the godforsaken Jim Herd, who has managed to screw the pooch on so many different levels. And, you know, he doesn't have money for anything else, but he's got money to hire 40 models to come and just walk to the ring with Ric Flair for a good 45 seconds, turn around. And I wanted to know how much money they put out for those models because, you know, it could have easily – you could have had one woman walk out with Ric that was smoking hot and paid her a hell of a lot less money and given some of the money to the boys. Tommy Young was the official. Tommy Young, we've mentioned before, was the perfect – third man in the ring, almost acting as a foil for these two guys because Tommy's facial expressions were so precise, Barry. When Ric Flair would lay a chop in and Ricky Steamboat would just like start cringing and he'd hold his arms up to his chest and you could see Tommy Young just making the expression on his face like, oh my God, that had to hurt so bad. You know, and as one thing I will mention, something that was pointed out to me by my friend Greg Good was perhaps I might have been allowed my opinion to be weighted by the fact that I was actually there live. I had flown up with my friend Dave Flaherty, and we were sitting at the match. And one thing I do remember was that we were sitting there, and the match was – this was going on late afternoon. This wasn't like an 8 o'clock pay-per-view. This might have even been a 4 or 5 o'clock pay-per-view. But after this match was over, we had to literally dash to the airport because our flight was leaving at like, I don't know, 8:45. And we were, you know, doing the run through the airport kind of thing. But the fact that I was there live, I mean, there's no question about it that it preyed on my mind and it influenced my vote because, you know, I was able viscerally to experience the world title change. And, you know, when I look back on it, Barry, I remember being there live thinking that the crowd, while it wasn't as bad as the crowd in New Orleans, that the crowd wasn't that great. But when I watched the match here the other day, I thought to myself, well, you know, considering that these two have absolutely no history in Nashville, the crowd was pretty into it. I mean, they definitely were a lively crowd. I would have preferred for a match like this to have that had a history in a place like Greensboro or Charlotte or something like that, that it had taken place in one of those towns. But, you know, let's be honest, the Crocketts and Dusty Rhodes and the folks in WCW had pretty much burned the Carolinas right down to the ground. And so, you know, I sort of understand why they wanted to take it to different places. They didn't want to be seen as just a Southern promotion. So they were taken into different areas. So that being said, the Nashville crowd was actually pretty good. Flair just looks absolutely perfect. Steamboat comes to the ring. He's got the wife and the kid. The kid is wearing this little cowboy outfit with a guitar. I made the I don't know if I ever told you this, Barry. I made the unfortunate comment. Middle of the card, I was walking around the arena with Dave Meltzer, and we happened to run into Bonnie Steamboat, who was carrying a little Ricky. And I made the, if you recall the history of Ricky and this particular individual, I made the unfortunate remark that, oh, a kid looks just like a little honky tonk man, which that comment didn't go over real well with Bonnie. But so we've got the three judges at ringside. We've got Lou Thesz, Pat O'Connor, Terry Funk. They make mention that Flair is attempting to tie Lou Thesz's record of 6 times being the world heavyweight champion. And so the match starts, and you know, it's tremendous. You pretty much have set the table there, Barry. The match, I can only really count one spot that I thought could have been a blown spot, but Flair covered for a missed drop kick by taking the bump over the top rope. And you really have to really look deep to notice that he didn't really catch Flair, because Flair timed the bump off the missed drop kick so perfectly that it looked like he'd actually connected. So ends up Flair gets the title. Steamboat, Ever the Gentleman, shakes his hand, raises Flair's hand as the new champion. Flair makes a comment to the effect that Ricky Steamboat is the greatest champion he's ever faced, the greatest wrestler that he's ever faced. And he's very gracious in accepting the title. And then during the interview with Jim Ross, at this point, Terry Funk comes into the ring. One of the judges wants to congratulate Ric Flair, says that if it had gone to a time limit draw based on what he had seen, that he, in fact, would have given the match to Ric Flair because he thinks that Ric Flair would have been ahead on points. And so the crowd is politely applauding. And then he kind of mentions that he'd like to throw his name in the hat as a potential challenger and maybe get a shot at Ric Flair for one more run of the title. And Rick makes some comments to the effect that, you know, we wrestle the top 10 wrestlers here. And quite frankly, you've been out making movies in Hollywood with Sylvester Stallone. And so so Terry, of course, does that. Oh, shucks, Rick. You know, I was just kidding, as only Terry can do it, and reaches over to shake Flair's hand. And when Flair reaches out to grab the hand, so he's sucker punched by Terry. And then Terry just goes bananas and he becomes Terry Funk, and he becomes the Terry Funk that both you and I love, Barry. And he proceeds to just open up a can of whoop ass on Ric Flair, throws him out of the ring. Jim Ross is doing a great job of selling, and Bob Caudle is doing a great job of selling the carnage as the poor nature boy is just being annihilated by the terrible Texan Terry Funk. Chairs to the head. The crowd at ringside is engaged. There's a guy at ringside that the cops are standing between him and Terry as he begins yelling at Terry. It's just great, awesome stuff to watch Terry interact with the fans at this point. And then they do the spot on the table that apparently was supposed to be gimmick but was not, where he gives Flair the pile driver. Flair falls to the floor. And a great spot, Terry takes a table and hits the prone Flair over the back of the neck with the chair. Just looked great. And there was just so much great. And then, you know, we had talked before in a previous episode about how Terry liked to sort of walk that fine line, Barry, during his interviews. And we've commented before about how he liked to do interviews. And one of the things that Dusty Rhodes hated for Terry to say was that he was fat, because, of course, he didn't want the fans to be reminded that he was fat. And so here, as Flair is as Funk is raging after his attack on Flair, he says, look at him. Look at the horse tooth banana nose. And which I just thought was priceless, that he was pointing things out about Flair that no one really wanted to acknowledge. And of course, his priceless line, he said, I'm not good enough. So to me, Barry, this was almost a perfect match. And that I wrote down at the end, perfect. Because, you know, in retrospect, and honestly, I haven't watched this match in probably a good 10 or 15 years. But when I watched it, the entrance was perfect. The match was perfect. The finish was perfect. And the angle afterwards, You know, of course, the one thing I've always said was I never understood why Ricky Steamboat didn't run back into the ring to save his old rival Ric Flair to naturally set the table for the Steamboat Funk feud that they could have carried through the Bash and let Flair have time to recover. But of course, you know, try thinking logically with the people that were in charge of WCW at the time, Barry.
Yeah, and I think according to Steamboat, he said he was not aware that nobody had clued him into the fact that Terry Funk, they were going to do this angle at the end of the match.
That's correct.
What he's claimed in interviews. Yeah, so that's really, that just shows you, A, that people running a wrestling company should know about fucking wrestling if you're going to run it, because you would want to clue the guy in. Even if you weren't going to have Steamboat run down, the guy should at least know what's going to be taking place after the match. It's almost ridiculous. But Terry Funk here, and we certainly, God knows I've certainly gushed like a six-year-old schoolgirl over Terry Funk numerous times on this podcast. This is Terry Funk at his best. And as you just said, you were 99.9% correct with that, Jeff. He just kept saying, he said, I'm not good enough. He said, I wasn't good enough. And he's screaming that, and he's going after fans. He goes from this nice, genial Terry Funk in the ring to this complete lunatic by the end. It's a complete 180, and he's screaming and going after everybody. And to me, within 5 minutes, Terry Funk has just made himself in WCW. Like, you talk about a debut. Here was a guy that was a non-factor. He was like a retired judge outside the ring, just, you know, a judge of a wrestling match. And within 5 minutes, he's become the number one heel in the company. That's amazing. And only Terry Funk could do that.
Yeah, it really was. And you know, it's just amazing to me that you're absolutely right. Funk was made in that 5-10 minutes. He had made himself the number one heel in the company. But, you know, getting back to the match, one of the other notes that I made, I just had a chance to finally watch the G17 tournament or whatever in New Japan, the match between Tanahashi and Ibushi. And, you know, as I watched Steamboat in this match, I found myself really connecting more with that match because of the facial expressions that Ibushi uses, the facial expressions that Tanahashi uses to sell a hold. They're very Steamboat-esque. And when I say that, that is as high a praise as I can give, because to me, Steamboat is just next level from anybody else. He's even better than Wyndham and Ricky Morton, and his ability to draw empathy and sympathy from the crowd. And that's what I see when I see guys like Tanahashi and Kota Ibushi, that they have that ability to admit the cry for sympathy just with their facial expressions. And Ricky Steamboat was so good at that. And it's still almost 30 years later, Barry, it just absolutely amazes me that fucking idiot Jim Herd decided to let Ricky Steamboat walk away from the company 2 months after he had maybe it was more like three, but he let him walk away from the company, a talent like that, who was probably top five in the world. And for whatever reason, I don't care what the reason was, but you let him walk away. If nothing else, you keep him on the card to let him bring along young kids and show them the way to go. And you let him walk away. It's just absolutely mind-boggling to me, Barry.
Oh, it's absolutely. We talked worst gimmicks of all time and things like the ding dongs. And the truth is, you know, look, I know that there's good gimmicks and bad gimmicks and all mistakes are made, but something like the ding dong should have never seen the light of day. And there's this whole, you know, I know we've talked about this going back to like the early episodes, but some of the shit that takes place behind the scenes in professional wrestling based off of political reasons is the kind of stuff that would make front page headlines if it was quote unquote a legitimate company. You know, if this kind of stuff was happening with, you know, McDonald's, which is a big company, or Apple products, or any stuff like that, you know, yeah, exactly. You know, how do you let Ricky Steamboat walk away? You know, it literally doesn't make any sense. But again, there were dozens, if not hundreds, of horrific mistakes made that damaged the company. And really, that's why they're no longer in existence. I mean, you know.
Sure.
It's insane.
So anyway, folks, definitely this match still holds up. If you haven't seen it, if you somewhere have been in a cave and you haven't had a chance to watch this match, It's just absolutely great storytelling, great action, a great angle. The announcing, you said it, Jim Ross was absolutely at the top of his game here. I know he's criticized by quite a few people nowadays, but 1989 Jim Ross calling a Steamboat Flair match was as good as it gets. And, you know, I would compare Jim Ross at this point, and Barry, you know what high praise is, that this was Soli-esque. You know, this was Lance Russell and Memphis-esque. That's how good Jim Ross was at this time.
Yep.
So Barry, it is now time for America's favorite game show.
Uh-oh.
Barry, time for Florida Man or No. Are you ready, Barry?
I am all ready. Let's do this. I'm so excited about this, too. And it's kind of cool to watch that people in our Facebook group, too. And I got to say, so in seeing what our download numbers are, and then taking into account that people are listening to us who aren't even downloading the show, the Facebook group is a very small portion of what's actually happening. So if you're listening to the show, please join us in our Facebook group. You'll be able to interact with other listeners. It's insanity in there. It's a complete free-for-all at times. It's a lot of fun. We do have a couple of rules, which are very basic and common sense related. But at the same time, some people have really embraced this, because I see stories every day about stuff happening in Florida, and people are actually putting it up there. And why is it that Florida gets these stories? I mean, there are 49 states other than Florida. There are a couple of territories that are out there. Why is it that all this shit happens in Florida?
It's amazing, Barry, truly. So, okay, Barry, here's our first story. You ready?
Yes, sir.
A dead baby whale, too big for a transport container, flopped onto the concrete in a parking lot, and the 4,000-pound mistake was all caught on camera. Oh, that's just terrible, gasped Sarah Rogers, a resident, as she watched the video. The whale had washed ashore on Monday morning. Experts say it likely died after getting tangled in fishing lines, and crews added insult to injury when they tried to move it. There was a mistake that shouldn't have happened, and I take full responsibility, said the police chief, Kevin Walsh. Walsh said it was a coordinated effort to remove the dead animal from the public beach. The town called on the state to bring in the dumpster holding the carcass for a necropsy. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
Jeff, do you ever see that movie Reno 911 Miami?
I did not. I know what you're talking about, though. I've seen the show, but not the movie.
Oh, it's the funniest movie. It's one of the funniest movies, and we've never talked about it. But there's a scene in there where a dead whale washes up on shore in Miami Beach, and the Reno Police Department decides to blow it up. And, of course, it just sends whale carcass flying everywhere. I am going to say, yeah, this is a tough one. I'm going to say this did not occur in Florida.
You are correct, sir. New Hampshire.
Wow. All right.
Okay. Our second story. A 28-year-old man who contracted syphilis after licking a dance pole has filed a lawsuit against the strip club. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
A guy licked a stripper's pole and contracted syphilis.
During the performance, one dancer apparently, quote, squirted on the dance floor, on the dance pole, which the person decided to lick before suffering from symptoms of syphilis days later. Florida or not Florida? Barry?
Fucking, that's gold right there. Of course that happened in Florida. That's absolutely a Florida story.
That is not a Florida story. That is an Oregon story.
Guy got syphilis from a stripper's pole. I love it.
That's like getting VD from the toilet seat, Barry.
I got from the toilet seat, exactly.
Exactly. Awesome. So, yeah. Okay. Barry, an amusement park is betting money that you won't take them up on their bet if you could last in a coffin for 30 hours during the Halloween Fright Fest, you could win $300. Barry, is that a Florida story or no?
That is not a Florida story.
Six Flags St. Louis. You are correct, sir. So let's see what
I'm 2-1 for this episode. All right.
Okay, Barry.
Yeah.
An intoxicated man started a fire while making cookies in the nude on a George Foreman grill.
Where the fuck are you finding these stories? That's awesome.
When police arrived at 5:30 local time, a naked man opened the door, told the police officers, "I'm sorry," and closed the door. The nude man then opened the door again, leaving it ajar as he retreated back into his home. The man didn't seem to either care or understand the potential danger he was in, as firefighters were called to put out. The man confessed to drinking 2 liters of vodka and smoking weed around 9 a.m. Go figure, Barry. He was making cookies on the George Foreman grill. At least he didn't put his foot on it, though.
Yeah, have you... I've cooked on a George Foreman grill. How in God's name would you try to make cookies on a George Foreman grill?
I don't know,
wow.
But Barry is
that's got to be Florida. That's got to be Florida.
That is Niceville, which is up in the Panhandle, very close to where my brother lives. I'm not going to take any credit for that, though, Barry. Barry, the next Florida man or not story. Residents received a power outage notice that also warned of zombies. The message was sent around 1:45 a.m. Imagine getting this message, Barry. Oh, power outage and zombie alert for residents. And Terminus, there are now far less than 7,380 customers involved due to extreme zombie activities. Restoration time uncertain. Barry, Florida or not?
Oh, so this sounds like something from The Walking Dead, because several years back there was a storyline that involved Terminus, which was, I believe, the area where Denise Crosby, and they were actually cooking survivors or killing survivors and eating them in order. And I believe that was all related to Terminus. I am going to say it is not Florida. I'm even going to guess that maybe it was Georgia.
You are incorrect, sir. Lake Worth, Florida.
Damn it.
And what
Damn
makes it even better is the communications specialist for the Lake Worth, FPNL or something, Florida Power and Light, is quoted as saying, "We are looking into reports that the system mentioned zombies. I want to reiterate that Lake Worth does not have any zombie activity currently." That he felt compelled to mention that, Barry, just absolutely
currently.
Slays.
Yeah, currently.
Yes, currently.
It could change tomorrow, sure. Yes. Yeah, I like that,
Barry,
too.
Yeah, that's a good one. So what are you, two for two now?
I think I'm getting an F at this point. I've got a grade of F, but I got to admit, I'm really entertained by these stories, though.
Okay, last one, Barry. Let's see if you can go over the Mendoza line here.
Okay.
Police are investigating after a Facebook video surfaced of a 10-year-old getting a tattoo in the living room. According to authorities, the boy's mother allowed him to get the tattoo. Police said it's not yet clear who should be charged or what crime, if any, has been committed. Barry, Florida or not Florida, with a 10-year-old getting a tattoo.
Oh, and so here's the worst part. I was aware of this story. I just didn't read the story. I only saw the headline, and I'm like, do I really want to watch this video of a 10-year-old? Because apparently she videotaped it. Do I want to watch the videotape of a 10-year-old getting a tattoo? I don't. I am going to say not Florida.
This, in fact, Barry, you are correct, took place in Ohio. Not just Ohio, but Belle Fountain, Ohio, where my children's father was originally from. I, of course, am their adopted father, but their natural father was originally from Belle Fountain, so I had to make a special mention of this story. Belle Fountain lets the 10-year-olds get tattoos. Barry, what can I tell you? Quality parenting.
Quality parenting for sure. And I did like the mother. And then the mother was justifying it, which I heard this on the radio as well. The mother was justifying it by saying it's not a real tattoo, even though apparently it really was a real tattoo. And then she said, well, he wanted the tattoo. So
yeah, here's a little parenting tip from your friends at Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. As a parent, sometimes you're allowed to say no. A lot of people don't realize that, Barry. All right, folks, it's now time for the old top five list. Barry, you ready to go?
I am. I'm ready, and I'm really excited about this one, too. And I have a feeling, Jeff, and this goes back. I was thinking about this today. As I think about random thoughts that really don't mean much, I was thinking about when we did our favorite movies and how different the list was, and you were putting forth these really, I remember saying this and saying this more than once, how you were putting forth these really deep movies and really intricate plot lines. And then I was talking about movies with intestines killing people. So I got the feeling that today's list, we may see something similar where I think I'm going to go in one direction and you're going to go in a different direction.
I think we can pretty much guarantee that, Barry. So, okay, let's start.
Yeah.
Your number five favorite pre-1970 movie.
Absolutely. So my number five pre-1970 movie. And this was tough because I, as we always do, we generally start off with like 10 or 15 and then we whittle it down. So I think I was close to 20 movies and I went down to five. And this is from 1932. It is one of the universal horror films. And it's really my favorite of the classic horror films, which would take into account something like Dracula and Frankenstein, the Wolfman. But for me, it is Boris Karloff as the Mummy. I absolutely am enthralled with this movie. I got to say, on one of the cable channels over the last few weeks, they have been playing all the classic horror films, all the Universal classics, and I have DVR'd them all. And I watched The Mummy again, which has been my favorite probably for the last 20-something years, and I'll tell you why. And it is such a good movie, and it's one of these movies that I think anybody could watch and like. And it's while it's not the scariest of all the movies, there's something about it that, you know, it's hard for me to believe that this movie is, you know, almost 90 years old. You know, what is it, 86 years old? Hard to believe it because it's just, it's so well done. But my wife and I, when we lived in New York City pre-having children, there are, that's one of the beauties of New York City is that there's all these old revival houses where you could go and see movies, and they were doing all the classic horror movies on the big screen. And we went on a Sunday night. I remember this. We went and grabbed dinner. It's a Sunday night. We watched The Mummy, and we sat there, and I'd already seen it, but I love on the big screen. I was, it's, you know, everything's better on the big screen. And my wife, who had never seen it, goes, "Oh my God, that's really good." The movie right after was another Mummy movie. And we stayed for that one, which was not as good. But the point being that, you know, my wife was so taken with the first one that she would watch a second one. But The Mummy, 1932, it's a team of archaeologists discover the mummified remains of the ancient Egyptian priest Imhotep, played by Boris Karloff, along with his legendary Scroll of Thoth. When one of the archaeologists recites the scroll aloud, Imhotep returns to life but escapes. Several years later, Imhotep is taken on the guise of a wealthy man as he searches Egypt for his lost love, who he believes has been reincarnated as the lovely Helen Grosner. So it's just such a good movie. It's so well acted. You know, unlike a lot of the other Universal monster films too, The Mummy actually didn't even have a sequel. There were other mummies that came out, but nothing that was directly related to this film. And certainly they've remade it. Brendan Fraser had a couple of mummy movies, and Tom Cruise had one, I believe, last year, maybe the year before. You know, this is so cool too. And seeing Karloff, and he's only got a few scenes where he's full out mummy, because apparently the makeup artist would start transforming Karloff about 11 a.m. in the morning, completing the job at 7 p.m. So a full 8 hours later, Karloff would then finish his scenes at 2 a.m. and then spend another 2 hours removing the makeup. So you hear these stories like this, and then anybody, The Wizard of Oz, you know, they were spending this tremendous amount of time in the makeup chair just to be able to do a few scenes. So, you know, a lot of respect for a lot of these actors. But have you ever seen the original Mummy?
Yes, I have. It's a fantastic movie.
It really is. And it's, you know, it's, there are certain movies that, you know, and it's certainly, you know, when I had my list, one of the things I took into consideration when we're talking about movies is how well does it play 50, 70, 80 years later? And The Mummy to me almost looks like it could have been made 20 years ago, you know, even though it's 86 years old. Just a fantastic movie. And Karloff, you know, I know Bela Lugosi wasn't a fan of Karloff, but I certainly am.
Okay, my number five movie, Barry, comes from 1944. Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, the old star of My Three Sons. Barry, I'm talking Double Indemnity. Barry, you ever seen that?
It's been years, but yeah, that's a great movie.
And I'll tell you what's great about this. This is it's also got Edward G. Robinson. It's kind of a precursor to film noir, if you will. It concerns a woman who's plotting to get an insurance scam, and she's being investigated by an insurance agent that's played by Edward G. Robinson. And he's there's a murder and insurance money involved. And Fred McMurray actually, I believe, plays a police officer who's trying to – police officer or an insurance agent, I'm Right now I'm drawing a blank on that. But anyway, what's great about seeing Fred McMurray in this role is people, a lot of people know Fred McMurray, if you're an old movie fan, from like Disney movies like Flubber and Son of Flubber, My Three Sons. And in this movie, it's awesome to see Fred McMurray play a complete shitheel. I mean, because he's a guy that is – he is sniffing around Barbara Stanwyck, who looks unbelievable. She's a platinum blonde in this movie. And there's a great scene where she comes walking down a staircase, and he looks at her, and she's wearing an ankle bracelet. And he says, "That's a honey of an ankle bracelet." And just that comment – the way he said it, he says it. Now, you have to remember, this is 1944, that it's said with such a leering intent. And Barbara Stanwyck says something to the effect of, you're getting a little too close for comfort. He says, well, am I passing the speed limit? And she goes, you're way over the speed limit at this point. And the sexual tension and interplay for a movie from 1944, Barry, is fantastic. And Double Indemnity is a great, great movie.
You may have actually recommended this to me a few months back, but this was on a cable channel. Maybe it was like Turner Classic Movies, and I wound up watching it. I think I was up one night, like having a migraine headache at like 4 a.m., and it happened to be on, and I just sat there and watched it. And you were right about Fred McMurray, too, because we're so used to him as being this nice, genteel, fatherly figure. And then all of a sudden, he is this really just awful heel, but just solid acting. Fred McMurray, underrated or underappreciated as an actor, because everybody knows him from My Three Sons or a Disney movie. But and Barbara Stanwyck, you know, I think we knew Barbara Stanwyck. Was it The Big Valley that she was on?
Yes,
for years.
But she played like the matron of The Big Valley, you know.
Yeah, she was right. She was though she ruled with an iron fist. She was the matron, but she was a massive and major star in the 1940s for Hollywood, you know, when making movies and stuff. So this is an excellent movie, too. This is I fully agree. This deserves to be on anybody's list if you're talking pre-1970 films.
OK, number four, Barry.
Number four. So I am going to stay in a similar genre of horror. It is 1954's Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is probably one of my favorite movies of all time as well. I got to meet the guy that played the creature. His name is Raccoon Browning, and he's a guy that he travels the horror circuit. And he's got to be in his late 80s at this point. I met him a few years ago. Real fun guy, I don't want to say boisterous, but he's outspoken and he has a lot of fun. And he's not a shy, quiet guy, having a lot of fun. But got to meet him, and you start asking him stories about the movie, and I'm sure he's been asked these questions 87 million times. But he comes forth with this enthusiasm when he answers your question, like it's the first time anybody's ever asked him, like, what was it like to work with Richard Carlson, you know? So it just I had a lot of respect, but I love this movie. And if you've never seen Creature from the Black Lagoon, which I'm sure if you've never seen it, you at least know what it's about, because the creature is kind of an iconic figure. A geology expedition in the Amazon uncovers fossilized evidence, which is a skeletal hand with webbed fingers that provides a direct link between land and sea animals. After members of the camp are killed, they discover the Gill Man, who is taking a liking to Kay, who is the girlfriend of the lead archaeologist. This was filmed at various locations throughout the state of Florida, which is kind of cool because, you know, there was that period in the, especially in the 60s, the 50s saw it, but the 1960s with Ivan Tor's studios, with doing Flipper, and anytime there was something filmed on the water, it was almost always taking place in Florida. But this was filmed in Marineland, Silver Springs, Wakula Springs, Green Cove Springs. If there was a Springs in Florida, they filmed a fucking scene for this movie there. The creature was actually played by two different people. I just mentioned Raccoon Browning, who did it underwater. On land, it was a guy named Ben Chapman. Why they had two different people, I have no idea. The creature from Black Lagoon was actually filmed in 3D. And that was because in 1950s, 3D was a really big deal. They filmed it in 53, but it was fading by 54, and people were rejecting the 3D craze. And even though the movie had been filmed in 3D, most of the theaters that showed it were showing it in 2D because nobody gave a shit about 3D anymore. The film did have two sequels. I have seen both. One was on Svengoolie. Jeff, do you ever watch Svengoolie?
I do not.
So Svengoolie is a guy, I believe he's based out of Chicago. It's Rich Kaz, who is a local comedian and I guess a TV celebrity in the area. But he plays a horror movie host, and it's kind of like the Zacherlees and the, you know, the Goulardis. So it's kind of a throwback to the horror movie host of the 60s and 70s. But Svengoolie was playing one of these a few weeks back, and I watched it. And did you see the movie last year, The Shape of Water, the Guillermo del Toro film?
Actually, that is coming out on HBO either this weekend or next weekend, and I already have a DVR because you recommended it to me.
It is such a great movie too, and I want to say it won Oscar for the best picture, and as somebody who is a horror movie fan and likes it, it's, you know, to see that this movie wins best picture, it's almost justification for all the shit that's been hurled our way being a horror movie fan for all the years. But it's almost Creature from the Black Lagoon in a lot of ways. It's a gill man who lives underneath the water. But the film Shape of Water was partly inspired by Guillermo del Toro's childhood memories of Creature from the Black Lagoon, and he always wanted to see gill man get with the woman, Kay, which didn't happen in the movie. I won't tell you what happens in Shape of Water, obviously, because I don't want to spoil it for you. But at the same time, I highly recommend that movie. I'm excited you get to see it.
Yeah, I actually recently, I think within the last month or two, Creature from the Black Lagoon was on, I don't know, one of these TCM or channels, and I DVR'd it and watched it, and it's really a lot of fun. The great sound that accompanies every time the creature shows up. It's definitely a fun movie, no question about it. Okay, my number four, Barry, 1953, director Billy Wilder's Oscar-winning Stalag 17 with William Holden, and one of his truly great, great performances. He plays a prisoner of war who is suspected of being an informant for the Nazis and is subject to repeated beatings from his fellow POWs. And all the while, he's out there looking to find out who the real turncoat is, the real plant that the Nazis have inside the barracks. And it's just a terrific movie. And, you know, it's amazing that this movie supposedly inspired them to make the television show Hogan's Heroes, because the two are absolutely nothing alike, Barry. You've seen Stalag 17?
I got to be honest. I don't know that I have. I want to sit here and I want to say I think, but I'm not really quite sure that I have.
Yeah, it's got a really good cast, a lot of great character actors that you would recognize, including one who was one of the stars of the movie Airplane. I'm not going to give it away because he is the guy that is revealed at the end. But it is kind of a surprise when you see him. Because he's he can't be more than 25 years old when he made this movie, Barry. But a great, great film. And William Holden is a J.J. Sefton, who is a guy that is sort of the barter guy in the camp. He anybody that needs something, he can get it for you. So I strongly encourage you to check out 1953 Stalag 17. Really good stuff. Barry, number three.
Yeah, and hey, before I forget, so I was trying to think of the character from The Big Lebowski, the video artist. It was Knox Harrington.
Okay.
Shit that just comes at you when you just stare at the wall for a minute, you know, so I didn't remember that. So, exactly. So my next film is The Wizard of Oz, Jeff. It is 1939's Wizard of Oz. I'm not going to say anything right here that is going to, you know, everybody has seen The Wizard of Oz. Apparently it is, it's been chosen as the most watched film in the history of movies by the Library of Congress. Everybody apparently on the face of the earth, whether you live in a remote jungle in the Congo or you live in Ambler, PA or Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you've seen The Wizard of Oz. It's a tremendous movie. It still plays well to this day, because it's so spectacular. I'm going to tell you, I love the movie, and I'm going to tell you what I think my connection to it is that I've gone full circle with this movie, and I think a lot of people have. And this was a movie, if you remember as a kid, when we only had four channels of television. We had, you know, CBS, ABC, NBC, and then we had, you know, like a UHF channel. But CBS would play The Wizard of Oz on a yearly basis. And I watched it every year as a kid. My parents watched it. It was almost a family thing. And I think a lot of families did that. And we would watch The Wizard of Oz. And then as I got older, a young adult, and I discovered inebriants, I would take said inebriant, and then I would watch The Wizard of Oz. And it took on a different meaning at that point. And then as an adult, a more responsible adult, I started to watch The Wizard of Oz with my kids. And it was kind of like one of those movies that comes right from my childhood that I could share with my kids. So it's such a great movie. I love the music. It's such a positive vibe. And I'll share two last things. And I know that, you know, I know we've got to get going so we don't have a 40-hour show here. But when I worked at Tavern on the Green in 1984, the owner and operator of Tavern on the Green was a guy named Warner LeRoy. And Warner LeRoy was the son of Mervyn LeRoy, who was a famous Hollywood producer and was the producer and actually partly of a director of The Wizard of Oz. And one of the stories was that Warner would claim was that he actually got to bring Toto home and own Toto after the film.
Nice.
And I don't know that to be true. I don't know if that was just, but that was one of the stories that was going around, which I just thought was so, so interesting, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's cool stuff, Barry. Okay, my next movie, my number three movie, is going to be from 1962. Barry, a very controversial movie in many ways. I'm talking director John Frankenheimer's movie, The Manchurian Candidate. And now I'm talking about the original Manchurian Candidate. It was recently a remake with Denzel Washington. And let me say, Denzel Washington is a fine actor. I got no problem with Denzel Washington. But to me, this movie was almost perfect. And I really hate when a perfect movie gets remade. And The Manchurian Candidate happened to come out and was released right around the general time frame, as, of course, we had the Kennedy assassination. And there were a lot of parallels between Lee Harvey Oswald and the character of Raymond Shaw, played by Lawrence Harvey in this movie. And this was quite the mind F of a movie, Barry, when it came out, because it looked into the way that POWs can be brainwashed by their captors into doing stuff that they don't even realize they're doing down the road. And I'll tell you the best part of this movie, great cast, Frank Sinatra, Lawrence Harvey, Janet Leigh, Henry Silva, James Gregory. But Barry, the amazing, you know, we talked about Fred McMurray, everyone's dad from My Three Sons, the person that absolutely steals this movie. Folks, if you have ever in your days had the opportunity to watch Murder, She Wrote, and you think that's what Angela Lansbury is all about, watch The Manchurian Candidate when she is the bitch mother of all time, Barry. She is epic in this, and I don't think she won the Academy Award, and that's a crime because she is amazing in this performance, Barry.
Yeah, The Manchurian Candidate is such a fantastic movie, and you're right about the sequels or the remakes. Why do you remake something that is so perfect? It doesn't make, you know, are you going to remake The Godfather next? You're remaking The Manchurian Candidate? It makes no sense. This is great, though, and it's you're right about Angela Lansbury also, too. So you get this, what was that Disney movie she was in? Do you remember that one?
Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Exactly.
And she's not the same person.
No, it's not even close. And she plays in that movie. She's like this nice grandmotherly figure, which is similar to what she did with Murder, She Wrote. And then you get her in this movie and she's the personification of evil. So that's a testament to being a great actress as well. And I believe she's still with us. She's got to be close to 90, if not in her 90s. But this is one one of the movie magazines, Premier Magazine, years ago, which, remember that magazine, Premier Magazine?
Sure.
Which was a great magazine. I doubt they're still around, but they did 100 movies you have to see before you die, and Manchurian Candidate was right up there.
And, you know, I will say, before I let you get to your number two, Barry, The Manchurian Candidate was pulled from circulation, I want to say, by Frank Sinatra, who was one of the producers of the movie.
Yeah.
Because of the parallels to the JFK assassination and what happens in The Manchurian Candidate. So it's a very, very kind of eerie parallels to that story, Barry. So, all right, give us your number two.
My number two is from 1960, so I'm getting a little more current. It's Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. So this was a tough one, and I felt compelled that I had to put at least one Hitchcock movie on my list, and I went with Psycho. And, you know, I could have gone, Rear Window, or I could have gone The Birds, because The Birds, my God, as a child, was I terrified of the movie The Birds. But I went with Psycho, and I think partly because I think it's such an example of great filmmaking, of how to make a horror film without really doing or giving away. Nothing is too graphic, but it's the tone that he did. And I think Anthony Perkins, this is at a different level, you know, his portrayal of Norman Bates in this movie. So if you've never seen Psycho, and I have to think that if you've never seen it, you at least know what it's about. But I pulled up this description, and I think this description was kind of funny. It says, Phoenix secretary Marion Crane, played by Janet Leigh, on the lam after stealing $40,000 from her employer in order to run away with her boyfriend, Sam Loomis, is overcome by exhaustion during a heavy rainstorm. Traveling on the back roads to avoid the police, she stops for the night at the ramshackle Bates Motel and meets the polite but highly strung proprietor Norman Bates, played by Anthony Perkins, a young man with an interest in taxidermy and a difficult relationship with his mother. I got such a kick when I read that. I thought that was great. So, this is such a good movie, and the shower scene, which has been talked about, so much had to go into that shower scene. It's like something like 74 edits in like a 40-second scene. It like set the record. It's just an amazing scene. It took him days to shoot the scene, even though it's over so quickly. This was actually, Psycho was Alfred Hitchcock's most successful film, financially speaking, which to me also, was also, Psycho was the first American film to show a toilet on screen. And it's also the first American film in which we hear a toilet being flushed. Psycho marked the fifth and final time that Hitchcock would earn an Oscar nomination for Best Director. But think about this for a moment. He never won that award. He never won an Oscar for directing his movies. And when you look at Psycho, in my opinion, it may be one of the most best examples of a perfect movie that's been directed. So it just, to me, it's absolutely insane. But here's a little fact, and then I know we got to speed this up, but the 1957 Ford sedan that Marion was driving was also a prop borrowed from the Leave It to Beaver set, where it served as the Cleaver's family car. Psycho and Beaver shot on the same lot at Universal Studios, but they also shared a makeup artist named Robert Dawn. Jerry Mathers wrote on his website that one day Robert Dawn brought the beaver to the set, and he would actually put some of the hairs on the skulls that they use for Mrs. Bates. So I just thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, Psycho, what a great movie. And I think it's one of the scariest movies of all time.
Who knew there was a Leave It to Beaver Psycho correlation? Stuff you only learn here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, folks. It's truly, truly amazing. Yeah, and that's, you're absolutely right. I mean, to think about the fact that here he made Psycho, he made Vertigo, he made North by Northwest, Rear Window, and even going back into the 40s, he was making some unbelievable films.
Yeah.
And that he's never been awarded with the Best Director Oscar is just absolutely amazing. Okay, Barry, my number two, I am going to 1946. Director William Wyler gave us The Best Years of Our Lives. And Barry, this is one I'm thinking this may have been in that film class that I've mentioned more than once. Essentially what it is it's three World War II veterans returning home to a small town to discover that their lives and their families have been irreparably changed. And, you know, so much of what was going on in Hollywood during the war, of course, as they were trying to get people to support the efforts against Japan and against Nazi Germany, you were seeing so many positive messages. The blood and guts stuff from John Wayne and people like that. And here, Barry, what you got that made this film so interesting and so compelling. And again, you have to remember the context one of my favorite words here over the course of a year, the context of when this movie was released, the war had just ended. And, you know, you don't often see movies about World War II that show post-traumatic stress and show the after effects of what a soldier goes through in war. You know, you see it all the time in movies from Vietnam. You see it in movies, films of the Iraq War, of the stress and the trauma that soldiers go through. But here, Frederick March returns to his job at a bank and is a closet alcoholic. You have Dana Andrews, who is a tank sergeant, who goes back to his job as a soda jerk at a department store and is dealing with stress and remembering what it was like to be in the bomber's window, dropping bombs on cities. And then, and perhaps the most amazing performance, you have a guy who I believe only acted in one other film, and that was Harold Russell. Harold Russell was in fact a quadriplegic from the war because of injuries. I think he was not a quadriplegic. He had lost both his arms, but he still had his legs. But what was shocking at the time this movie came out was there is a scene where he goes into the bedroom and his father takes his artificial limbs off of him and prepares him for bed. And then later in the movie, when he gets ready to marry the girl that has been his hometown girlfriend for their whole life, pretty much, that he went away from, you know, to war and came back, and he didn't want to marry the girl because he didn't want her to be exposed to what was going to be his life now as, someone who felt he was going to be physically crippled and couldn't go. He didn't want to burden her with that. And, you know, the scene where she comes in and is confronted with his physical disabilities of not having arms and needing to literally be tucked into bed and telling her, "I'm helpless until I call somebody and somebody comes and helps me get out of bed." It's just absolutely riveting, Barry. And the amazing thing was Harold Russell had not been an actor before that. He ended up getting if he didn't win the best supporting actor that year, he received some sort of special award from the Academy because his performance was so breathtaking. And it's just an absolute, I think it won the best picture award. And it's absolutely, all these years later, although it's dated, the message of the trauma and trouble that soldiers have coming back to their normal civilian lives and having to adjust, it's really gripping stuff, Barry.
Yeah, and so I have to admit too, I've never seen this movie either, and that's probably a flaw. That's a mistake on my part. This sounds really good too, and I've heard of the movie. You know, that's one thing too, is that, you know, I've heard of a lot of these movies, the ones that I haven't seen. But I'm actually going to go out and I'm going to see if I can get this either through Netflix or Amazon Prime, which has, you know, an amazing selection, so I could actually watch that. You just sold me on that, Jeff.
Yeah, it's a great film, no question.
Yeah.
So you're number one, Barry. We have been waiting.
We're here. We're here. We are at number one. So I'm going to preface this one too, and I'm going to say that I tend to gravitate towards the slightly, or sometimes not slightly, offbeat. And we certainly talk about a lot of it. There's nothing breaking with this one, and this is not a conscious decision. It's not like I sit here and go, you know what, I'm going to go like this because it's weird. You know, it's in my genetic makeup. But I have to think part of this goes back to my childhood, and I think I've always put the fact that I like the offbeat, I like the unusual, I like weird shit, and it goes back to two things. One is, and I can thank my father, actually, it goes back to professional wrestling, because when you're seeing guys like King Curtis at a young age, you know, when you're exposed to professional wrestling, especially in those days where it was treated as legitimate and it was a shoot because kayfabe had not been broken, that's the behavior that is in your head. So it's going to be a little weird. The second was when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my father took me to see a movie that was also really fucking bizarre. And there was a library, which I'm assuming still exists, on Miami Beach. It was right near the old Wolfie's Delicatessen. And they were showing a film, and my dad, who had, I guess, had seen this movie or knew of this movie, took me to see it. And I saw this movie, and I walked away, and I was completely enthralled with what I had seen. I was not frightened. I was not scared. It was a whole new world to me. So I had not seen this movie until I moved to New York. And in 1984, I'm walking down a very seedy part of Times Square, much like The Deuce, Jeff, one of our favorite TV shows. And up on the marquee in this disgusting theater, they were showing this movie. And I said to myself, oh, I got goosebumps. And I said, I got to go in. Whatever I'm doing, I'm going to see this movie. It is 1932's movie, The Freaks, which is actually just Freaks. There's no the before it. Have you ever seen the movie Freaks?
I know very well the movie you're talking about. I believe the director is Todd Browning. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Todd Browning. Yes.
I've never seen it, but I totally know the movie you're talking about. I've read about it. Yeah.
So I went into my father was still alive in 1984. So I went into the movie theater and I watched the film, and it's 65 minutes, somewhere right around there. So it's not a long movie. And I walked out and I went home or I went back to my apartment where I was living in New York, because really, who has a home in New York City? And I called my dad. And I said, Dad, you're not going to believe this. And I haven't thought about this in years, but I just saw this movie, Freaks. And my dad was very nonchalant about it. Like, okay, good, son. So what else did you do today? You know, what'd you have for lunch? And that kind of, he didn't give a shit. But for me, it was almost this like breakthrough moment of explaining to me, okay, this is why you're attracted to weird shit. So this movie, Freaks, is, if you've never seen it, it's highly recommended. It is only 65 minutes. The original version was 90 minutes. And because when it was released in 1932, there was such an outcry from the public that the movie was immediately cut from 90 minutes to 65 minutes, and that original version is completely lost. That other 25 minutes of footage does not exist. But it's essentially, it's about a trapeze artist named Cleopatra. She learns that one of the midgets of the circus, played by Hans, has an inheritance, and she marries him. Treating him like shit, but she plans to steal his fortune and run off with her boyfriend, who is the strong man of the circus named Hercules. When Hans's friends find out, and fellow performers, when they find out and discover what's going on, they band together and carry out a brutal revenge that leaves both Hercules and Cleopatra knowing what it truly means to be a freak. And in essence, they castrate Hercules, they turn her into like a bird woman, but they brutally just, you know, it just turned them into freaks. But this is a really unique movie because everybody in this movie, with the exception of the two that they turn into freaks, everybody was quote unquote a freak. And this is, you know, the old circus sideshows or the state fair sideshows where you had the bearded lady and you had the midgets and you had, you know, people that were deformed. There was Johnny Eck, you know, who was missing parts, and it just, you know, Prince Randian, who was a guy that had no arms and legs, and you know, it's just all these different types of abnormalities, human abnormalities. And this movie was filmed over a 2-month period in 1931 and then just released a few minutes later. Todd Browning, that you mentioned, Jeff, was a respected director going into this. He had directed Dracula the year before in 1931, which was one of the highest grossing films up to that time. And he was a guy that also had directed silent films. However, when he directed Freaks, it essentially ruined his career. Freaks was met with utter disgust by the majority of the general public, as well as reviewers. Some of the reviews that are out there: there is no excuse for this picture. It took a weak mind to produce it, and it takes a strong stomach to look at it. An outrageous onslaught upon the feelings, the senses, the brains, and the stomachs of an audience. And my favorite, anyone who considers this entertainment should be placed in a pathological ward in some hospital. So obviously there's a bed that's got my name on it somewhere in some hospital. But this is a movie that I've seen it multiple times since. I own it on videotape. So I should see if I can get it on DVD at this point. But it is massively entertaining. But there's a strong moral message to this movie, and I think that was lost in what Todd Browning was trying to bring forth, in that, you know, these are still people, that, you know, it may be a guy with no arms and no legs, it may be another guy that, you know, that again, that he's a midget, whatever it might be, you know, there was the pinheads, for lack of a better term. You know, they were called pinheads. These were people that were very different, that were, again, abnormalities, whether it was physical or mental, and they were put into these circuses. And there's a misconception about that, you know, because a lot of these performers were treated the best they'd ever been treated in these circuses or sideshows, because they were able to actually make a living, as opposed to being, you know, kept in somebody's house, sheltered away because the family was embarrassed about them. But there's a very strong moral message to this. At the same time, it's utterly fascinating to watch, and you're rooting for all of these circus, you know, abnormalities. I almost hate calling them freaks, though that's what the name of the movie is. But this is one of my favorite movies of all time. It is something that when you're done watching it, and you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, this movie will be on your mind. You do not forget what you're seeing. So it has obviously left an impact on me. Again, my slightly twisted personality, you can go directly right back to King Curtis in this movie, Freaks.
Okay. My number one choice for the best movie before 1970, Barry, I'm going to go a little more mainstream Hollywood, if you don't mind. I sat there and, you know, of course, we've talked about on this show before that I worked in the court system for going over 32 and a half years. Barry, 27 months. I'm down to 27 months before the big retirement cut kicks in. Yes, indeed. So, of course, working in the court system, I am attracted to movies about with courtroom drama and with cases. So let me just throw out two that are absolutely stellar, that as I was trying to decide my favorite one from 1957, Barry, we have Witness for the Prosecution, which was a film by director Billy Wilder, an absolutely amazing, amazing courtroom movie with Tyrone Power, Marlena Dietrich, Charles Laughton, Elsa Lancaster, just a tremendous, stellar, stellar movie with a great, great twist ending. From 59, Otto Preminger, Anatomy of a Murder with James Stewart and Lee Remick, Ben Gazzara. Ben Gazzara from what movie, Barry?
Oh, Ben Gazzara from two of my favorite movies of all time, Big Lebowski and Roadhouse.
Yes, and Ben Gazzara plays a soldier that's accused of murdering someone that he believes has raped his wife. And Lee Remick looking stellar in this movie, Barry. Just absolutely amazing. But those are two great courtroom dramas, but my number one movie before 1970, the ultimate, and here again, Barry, another movie that's been remade, 12 Angry Men from 1957. It is director Sidney Lumet's story of a jury trying to decide the fate of a young man that's been accused of, I believe, murdering his dad. Just one second here, Barry, as I pull it up. It's got a cast that includes Henry Fonda, and Lee J. Cobb, Martin Balsam, John Fiedler, so many great character actors, E.G. Marshall, Jack Klugman, Jack Warden, Ed Begley Sr., not to be confused with Ed Begley Jr., but just so many characters. We did our top five character actors. I think half of them that we talked about are in this movie, Barry. And what's great is Henry Fonda plays the lone holdout juror, trying to decide the fate of this young man. The rest of the jurors kind of just want to get in and out of there. And then as he asks them just to take the time to sit and talk about this man's fate, certain issues are revealed, various predispositions, dare I say, based on racial thinking or racist thinking, excuse me. We have the guy that just wants to leave so he can get to the ballpark. You have the young immigrant that believes in America and wants to believe in the American judicial system. And Barry, this movie is probably the finest example of what really goes on in a jury. I have to tell you, and I'll just say this real quick. You know, one of the things that I've learned through all my years working in the court system is you never truly know what goes on in that jury, because the jury's discussions are what is considered the legal term is inviolate. You cannot ask them, or they may not be forced to tell you what the discussions included. And, you know, my wife a couple of years ago served on a jury. She was the foreperson on a case of vehicular manslaughter. And she came home after the case was done and told me just about some of the different theories that people come up with. And you have all these TV shows, a CSI and NCIS, and what people expect and what they get as a jury is sometimes two completely different things. But this is a really fine example of the sort of discussions that go on inside the jury room. If you've never seen it, I absolutely encourage you to watch it because it is absolutely compelling, compelling stuff, Barry.
Yeah, so I think this is another one I don't think I've ever seen.
Oh,
so.
Barry, come on. You've never seen 12 Angry Men? Okay.
I don't, I don't think I have. Yeah.
You've got an assignment.
You're watching Freaks, right?
Yeah, you've got an assignment for the next episode. So,
yeah.
All right, Barry, we are getting the ringing of the bell from our good friend, the producer, the great Brian Last. So it is about time for us to, in UFC terms, to tap out here, Barry. So, Barry, I would like to thank everyone for 1 year's worth of listenership and 1 year's worth of friendship. We call ourselves the Brothership here on Breaking Kayfabe. And all those of you that listen, that are active on our Facebook group, we certainly appreciate your time. We appreciate you participating. I would just like to point out recently, since, as we said before, I have a wedding to pay for. My daughter, 3 weeks from now, is getting married. And I want to point out that Matt Kovacs and Rick Nathan, thank you for buying the shirts. So I want to mention people that have actually spent money on this show. That was pointed out to me. I also want to mention a special thanks to my friends, John McAdam and Johnny Hitchcock, who were the co-host of the, I think, the second and third, before I saw the light and brought Mr. Rose into the fold with a very exclusive contract, Barry. I think you'll agree. So,
oh, yeah.
So I would encourage all of you to follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network and our good friend, Mr. Brian Last. So let's hope we can keep it going for another year, folks. Thank you so much. Have a good one.